Today's podcast is sponsored by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/GOT and using GOT promo code at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 7, Episode 5, titled Eastwatch. Aaron, we've seen it twice now. Our instant take was, I would say, pretty brutal. It was negative in tone, certainly. After seeing it again, what do you think?
I think this episode was a very entertaining hour of television. It was deliberately constructed to be so. There was many, many callbacks to not only things that we fondly remember from previous episodes and previous seasons, but also pairings that we were long awaiting, meta references to meta conversations about the show out of the characters' own mouths. Like, those things were very delightful. But underneath that, like, I guess as I thought about this, my core complaint is that the overall thrust of the season, as I understand it, is dumb.
Okay.
Like, the idea that you can catch a white and then take it to Cersei.
The overall thrust of the episode.
And not that, because I don't think that would work, but the fact that the other characters that I consider smart and the ones that have suffered so much at the hands of Cersei and her backstabbing, the fact that any of them could think that this plan would work, that they would go and, mm-hmm. and have this dancing dead puppet and say, look, Cersei, and Cersei soberly looks and says, yes, I must commit the forces I don't have to this greater good of the realm, is just laughable.
It is.
Yeah. And there's also no hint that there's any kind of other side to it. Like, this is a trap they're going to set for Cersei to end it. And maybe that's where they're going, and then this will be brilliant. But, you know, as constructed, some of this stuff just seems ridiculous. Just, like, even if everything goes the way the heroes want it to, they're going to be left with a situation where their position on the board is not materially changed. And I can't get over that.
Yeah, and if it has changed, it's changed for the worse, because I'm looking at this and I'm saying, okay, they wanted armistice. They want a ceasefire while they deal with the threat from the north. Uh-huh. Best case scenario, that's going to decimate their forces.
Right.
Which, if they're successful, would leave them vulnerable potentially to Cersei Lannister,
right,
who's going to be there to play mop up.
Which, that's Dany's argument. That argument makes sense. Look, if I do what you want and I save the realm, I'm going to save it for Cersei Lannister.
Right.
Which maybe that's something that, as your Dany, you should do as an altruistic person.
Yeah, but I guess that doesn't leave, you know, the people there in the realm in much better of a situation than they started off in.
Right.
Which is unfortunate for them. But yeah, I do think that, yes, that was maybe the dumbest plot development in the entirety of Game of Thrones,
right,
that I've seen to date.
And it's almost like the Double D's knew that. Like, we have no great reason to bring these characters into these locations and delay this. So we're going
to... And we don't
to,
have time to manufacture those reasons.
So we're just going to do it and whistle and have Gendry pick up a warhammer and have Davos say, it looks like your arms are Jack from Still Rowan and crab meat,
right,
and it's going to be fine.
Yeah, and I definitely think the show is suffering from the pacing, the necessary pacing shortcuts that they're taking. But I do agree that it was also very entertaining. Like, I really, really enjoyed that scene with Davos where he's being, you know, Westerosi Han Solo, essentially.
Right.
I really liked a couple of other scenes in this, and I thought it was a lot of fun, even if it was different, I guess, from what Game of Thrones has been in the past. I think that's just the new reality we have to settle into.
Yeah.
Because this show doesn't have the time to be the old Game of Thrones anymore.
And I'm debating because, like, you know, one of the things we kind of made our bones on here at Bald Move is we just give our opinions. Most of the time it's good because we're covering good shows that we like. Some of the times they're negative. because either, you know, it strikes us funny or a show takes an occasional misstep, or sometimes it just turns into a train wreck. And I kept on thinking, like, I know just guys bitching about the show is not entertaining, but on the other hand, like, sometimes you can see when a show starts to spiral down. Like, remember season opener, season two, The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. The whole episode is constructed upon the fact that these group of survivors have to be surprised by this giant herd of zombies, and they chose to film it in the middle of a straight stretch of highway 10 miles long,
yeah,
where you have good visibility up and down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So when your eyes are saying, how the fuck can these guys be surprised that this is coming, and yet the whole episode is built upon you being like, well, forget what my eyes say. It's happening, so I have to go with it. That's the kind of stuff that erodes your suspension of disbelief.
It does.
And I think that, number one, I've decided it's not a huge concern for Game of Thrones, because at the end of the day, in eight more episodes, this whole thing's done.
Right.
Okay? So Game of Thrones cannot devolve into seasons worth of wasting our time.
No, it's going to do the exact opposite. It's going to potentially devolve into one season worth of skipping over important things that you kind of want to see.
Right.
In favor of the important things that need to happen to get to the conclusion of the story.
And also the other thing I think that, like, if you're looking... So the other side of the argument is, if you're looking for grand strategy and narratives to start open, it's not going to happen. Like, even if this was written perfectly, the show is coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So there aren't going to be any more grand, sprawling, epic things that can happen and betrayals, because there's not that much runway left.
Yeah.
And I don't – I mean, this is something we can debate once we see the whole series as a whole, but, like, it might be something that where people say, should the Double Ds have jettisoned intricate plotting and gone for spectacle – at this stage, should they put it off until the last season? Should, like, you know, what exactly? And there's so much meta analysis of, like, you know, like, we casually say, like, well, the Double Ds are sick of this, they want to be done. Like, that's just something I've gotten from a couple burnt out showrunners doing press.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you understand that, like, even if you love your job, nobody loves doing press for it. And on the press tour, when you're doing it for like 30 days and you just gotten done spending 10 months of your life making the thing, you probably just want to be like, God, can I get a month away so I can then plunge myself in another 78-hour work? So it's like, I don't even know if that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But yet that's the narrative, right?
Sure. Just like the narrative is, oh, every episode this season is going to be huge spectacle and longer than the average one. Turns out that's not actually true. None of that came true. It was simply... It was fan, you know, wishes,
right?
Essentially. Like, but, hey, we're so close to the end, it's got to be big, right?
Well, I also think that, you know, a lot of principals in the TV show encourage that type of thinking, too.
Sure. Why wouldn't they?
And they do. Like, even The Walking Dead in its old wheezing state, every single time you can find a press of Andrew Lincoln saying, oh, this year is the one where it gets really crazy. We'll wait till...
Right.
You know, it's like, okay.
You won't believe what crazy weapon Gendry uses.
Right. So it's like it's tough because, you know, there's a lot of blame and credit to go around. I don't think this episode's terrible. I do think that, and that's the thing, like the previous episode is really good.
Yeah.
And it left us with a bullshit half-ass cliffhanger of Jamie being in the water. No one believed that Jamie is going to die.
No.
But a lot of people are thinking, like, well, what's going to happen now? Like, this is, like, right next to Dany. This is the heart of the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what happens when him and Bronn get taken prisoner? What happens when the – and then the fact that they just wake up the next thing, they come up from air gasping for breath,
mm-hmm.
implying that they just now surfaced, and they're, like, a mile or two away down the river bend.
Yeah.
Flowing upriver.
Oh, they're upriver?
Like, because downriver would take them right to King's Landing. Well, maybe that's what happened. Then they crawled to King's Landing. But it just seems silly, because especially since they needed to get Tyrion and Jaime together so that Jaime could carry a message to Cersei. Well, a damn fine way to do that is to have him be captured.
Yeah.
And for Tyrion to be like, look, let my bro, this is the only person who will listen to the same fucking script and dialogue. You just tweak the situation. So, well, how did we get what we got? And, you know, are we bad people for sitting there and being like, oh, well, my fragile suspension of disbelief is teetering? Like, I don't know.
Well, I think it's the majority sentiment, honestly.
Yes.
Most of what I read over the course of the last 2 days has been, not entirely negative, but right. mostly negative about the pacing Worried. And about the plot developments yes. of this episode.
And I particular. Will say that this is not the first time this has happened on this show. Like, no. there was a lot of this similar sentiment in the midpoints of, like, season 5, where you were knee-deep in Bad Pussy. And
oh, sure. Yeah.
So, you know, this could be, like, last week was the most amazing episode ever. This week, fan service-y, plot kind of creaky. The next two episodes could make or break the season.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the other thing. It's like, what does that even mean? Like, the next two episodes are kind of turds, but spectacle. Like, they're still going to set records next year because who is going to nope out of 6 more episodes of Game of Thrones?
Nobody.
No. Even if you're going to hate watch it, you're going to watch it.
Even the people who say, I'm done, nope, this is it.
Right.
My final season. No, they'll be back for next season. You know you will.
Right. Especially since it's going to be 18 and you're going to miss it. And, you know, the only thing I guess the only thing I can promise is we'll be along the ride with you because we've always tried to... You know, we're not super meta. We don't have any industry connections. We're just watching this and talking about it like anybody else. So hopefully our reaction is representative of the larger fandom, or at least we can represent all the different voices of that debate. You know, and that's I guess that's the best we can do.
Yeah, I agree.
This seems very silly now, but I mentioned this in the spoiler podcast, but I know that the spoiler podcast traffic is not even a fraction of the main podcast. I actually looked into whether you can swim in a suit of armor, and it turns out some guy like 7 years ago had full like 50, 60-pound plate armor that he jumped in a swimming pool and attempted to swim, and it did not go well.
No, that's shocking.
Yeah.
Truly shocking.
So Vimeo, there's a Vimeo link that will be in the main podcast where you can actually see that, and that's pretty cool. You should check it out. But apparently Jamie was wearing plot armor, which is impervious to dragonfire.
A lot lighter.
As dense as styrofoam. Actually helps you swim.
Yeah.
So that's what he was rocking. But like I said, I did all that scholarly research and then wah, wah.
Yep.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Okay, let's get into the recap. We start off with Bron pulling Jamie out of the water.
I also like how I just described scholarly research as me watching a Vimeo video.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, that's what they mean. That's a definition, right?
Yeah, that is scholarly.
He questions why Jamie would do something as stupid as charging a dragon and says, hey, you can't die. No one gets to kill you except me until I get what I'm owed. Bron decides he's done fighting for the Lannisters, and Jamie decides that he has to tell Cersei about the dragons, which, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course you have to tell Cersei about the dragons.
Yeah. They're a game changer.
They are, for sure. There was some debate, not very vigorous, but obviously it was going to be Bronn who pulled Jaime out of the water. Nobody thought Dickon was the guy who ran up and charged and
there's a couple people making the argument, but yeah.
Yeah, they were obviously wrong. and this episode proved them so. There are a lot of good character moments between characters that are already established and have relationships, right?
Uh-huh.
Like the stuff with Davos and Tyrion later on,
yeah,
and Gendry, who's a new character essentially. But in this scene, I think there are some really good moments between Bronn and Jaime, where Bronn is fed up. Yeah, rightfully so. You know, this is not what he signed up for. He signed up to get a castle, to get a wife, and to settle down.
Yeah.
And now here he is out in a field getting attacked by dragons. This is not what he wanted.
Yeah, like...
no castle is worth this.
Dragons is where a partnership ends, as he says.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you got to be alive to enjoy a castle and a wife and a pile of gold.
Yeah. So I really felt for Bronn in this episode. He got bamboozled by Jaime and he's done with it.
Yeah, and I also wonder long term how damaged he is going to be inside the Lannister. I don't know what it wouldn't surprise me to see Bronn go over to Tyrion's side at this point.
Yeah,
like we might never Jaime's going to be like, okay, Bronn, let's go, and just Bronn's gone. He's over on Dragonstone. Like I'm back in the winning side.
So dragons, huh?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can shovel dragon shit with the best of them.
Right.
In fact, it's almost kind of a plot hole if he shows up and he's still with Jaime.
Yeah.
Are you telling me that Bronn can't smuggle himself out of King's Landing and row over to Dragonstone?
Oh, for sure.
And are you telling me that he shows up and says, I'm a friend of the Hand of the Queen, that Tyrion's going to reject him? Mm-hmm. No way. So, I know that. Bronn knows that. The play for Bronn is obviously to go to Dragonstone.
I think so, yeah.
All right.
Then we get some shots of Tyrion surveying the battlefield carnage. Dany gathers the remaining Lannisters and demands that they bend the knee or die. I actually wrote "and die" in this, which I'm not sure is completely wrong.
Yep.
Randall and Dickon both refuse to kneel, and Drogon burns them up.
Yeah.
This is an awesome scene.
This scene of Drogon, like we talked about in Instant Cast, but this scene out of Drogon atop the hill while Dany holds court is just something out of a Renaissance painting. It is.
It almost looks like the cover of all the cheesy fantasy books that you see.
Yeah.
But it's so well done.
Bjorn Vallejo or whatever. Like, you know, this is a Conan the Barbarian cover.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. And the fact that, like, I liked how, like, you know, there was a couple of dudes, like Lannister soldiers, like, yeah, fuck this, kneeling right away.
Yep.
And then, like, you know, Drogon roars at him and a couple more kneel. And then by the time Tarly's die screaming, everybody bends the knee.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like the fact that they had the, you know, a nice moment with Randall where he is, you know, confronted with the fact that he's already kind of flip-flopped before. Mm-hmm. You know, interesting, a lot of people emailed me and reminded me that Randall Tarly is one of the ones that fought for the Targaryens in the Robert's Rebellion.
Huh, okay.
In fact, they mention, Stannis mentions in season 4 or 5 to Sam when he's talking about it, that Randall is the only commander that handed Robert a defeat during the Battle of Ashford. So it is weird that he is so anti-Targaryen, you know, but I guess it's more... they try to show this from Tyrion's perspective, like just how lunar this battlescape was and how this is like something that is not normal and doesn't happen. And the fact that like the Dothraki are just there scavenging amongst the dead, that's kind of distasteful to a Westerosi eye, and how that these are foreign barbarians with a foreign queen. Like it's different, but it is weird that the show has positioned him as this like kind of like unmovable oak when he fought for the Targaryens and lost, fought for the Tyrells and lost, fought against the Tyrells, won, then fought against the Targaryens again, lost everything. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of complex stuff going on in this scene, specifically with Tyrion. He's looking at this devastation and probably just imagining this is what, even the people that he cares about in his family could look like. This is what everyone he knows from King's Landing would look like if the dragons attacked it.
Right.
He's also just like seeing how Dany treats anyone who doesn't, essentially bend the knee to her.
So I got a couple questions about that, about the wisdom of that. But I also don't know why Tarly didn't take the black, especially once his son was involved.
Yeah.
Like, he's got this bullshit, oh, well, you're not my queen, you've got no authority. Well, then you're going to die. And it seems like he wanted his son to kneel.
You think that's
an
option? I don't know that Dany would have let him take the black.
I read the scene. First of all, if she doesn't do that, then she's really flouting Westerosi conventions.
I mean, that's what she said is, you either bend the knee or you die. Yeah. That is your choice.
So how did you, I paid attention to the reaction when Tyrion suggested it, and it looked like she was open to it, and then he just arrogantly said, you don't have the authority, you're not my queen.
Right.
So then it's like, and that's why that... If they'd left that out, then I guess I would have felt more from Tyrion's perspective that, like, well, you could have not burnt the father and the child right there in front of everybody. But, like, the fact that there was a way out that he wouldn't even consider, like, that's that's a provocation against Dany's authority.
Okay.
Now, the flip side of that is, as she says, like, well, if you can be chained up, then a lot of people will take the chaining. The flip side of that is you're forcing a lot of people that are not loyal to you into your inner circle. Mm-hmm. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if there's a whole bunch of Lannister saboteurs going on now. And it's like, if it's all black and white, kneel or die, you're going to have a lot of kneelers with long knives behind their back ready to stab.
Right. This is why I can't remember if I said this in the instant take or not, but this is why I think that they're setting up Dany and Sansa to sort of be opposites in their leading styles. Because Dany is very much like... I'm going to make you bend the knee, and then I'm going to bring you into my fold. Whereas Sansa says, hey, I'm not going to force you into this fold. I'm going to make it a good idea for you to join me, and we're all going to work together to do this thing. As opposed to Dany, who says, I'm doing this thing, and you're getting behind me.
Right.
I feel like they're putting some weight to both sides there with those two characters.
But I thought the dialogue here with Dany's speech to the soldiers about how she come to break the wheel and don't believe the lies Cersei Lannister says, like that stuff was all really well done.
Mm-hmm.
This whole scene, pretty good.
It was. Then Jaime tells Cersei that he goes back to King's Landing, tells Cersei that they can't win the war, and oh, by the way, Olenna killed Joffrey. Cersei's pretty hesitant to believe that, but she eventually buys it.
So you think you did, guys? That's a question I had of whether you thought she in the end that Jaime persuaded her with his chain of logic and evidence.
Yeah, I think Cersei has not stopped stewing long enough to think about the logistics of it and why the motivations of it and why someone would want to kill Joffrey.
Right.
And then when Jaime brings that up, it makes a lot of sense to her because she knows Joffrey was a shit.
Yeah.
And that Tommen was docile little pet.
She did.
So, yeah. And then Cersei, they talk about the battle, and Jaime's trying to tell her, hey, we can't win this. She says she'd rather fight and die than surrender and die.
And also, they're in love with even numbers in the show. Apparently, Dany burnt 1,000 wagons.
I thought it was more like 12. But
right. So now it's plausible that... this is some kind of slow-moving holocaust we just saw.
Yeah.
The fact that she burnt up all the food in the realm. 1,000 wagons is a lot of... that's a lot of wagons.
A lot of food.
It's
And we know it wasn't gold, Because all the gold made it behind the walls.
Right.
So it may have been like armor and swords, but mostly and food.
They've established the North doesn't really have enough to feed their population. Mm-hmm. This is, I mean, what kind of Pyrrhic victory we're gonna win here? Like, okay, we saved the world from the White Walkers, but you're gonna starve because mm-hmm. you need to eat in the months it's gonna take to plant and sow and reap a harvest,
right?
Or will the show just not like it's 1,000 wagons, whatever? Euron's got 1,000 ships,
so I'm wondering, like,
John's got 10,000 dudes,
right? Danny's got 100,000. Why not?
Yeah, right.
How many Unsullied? I don't know. 1,000, 10,000. Yeah, who cares?
Is that believable? Whatever.
I'm thinking about, like, the long winter, right? Like, everybody talks about how long the winter is and how nobody really knows how long it can last.
Right.
When it comes,
the last
kind of
long
a rare
night
thing.
Was generational.
Right, right. So you would think, like, they would be super worried about food in that situation, right?
Right.
Because you can't really grow food during that period.
Sure.
So you have to stock it all up. Now, if they can successfully stave off that winter by destroying the Night's King or whatever, maybe they don't have such a problem, right? Maybe they have enough food to get through a few years, but
not a
decade.
That's true. Yeah.
So I'm hoping that is the case.
I get a lot of emails. I'm going to try to head them off. I got a lot of emails speculating on what's going to happen to the Long Night Part 2 that lasts for like a decade. And I'm just like, just stop. That's not going to happen. Because the show is going to wrap up one way or another before decades pass, okay? So, you know, depending on what Martin's playing at, either the White Walkers are going to win a swift and brutal victory and Westeros is populated by ice zombies, or they're going to... This is not the tale of the original Long Night, where generations of man suffer. Somehow they eke out an existence until the last hero arrives, / Azor Ahai, / the prince that was promised, and they forge a pact with the children of men with 12 companions. They go and somehow beat back the White Walkers, That's not what this story is about.
No, that is the last six episodes. That all happens.
Yes, yes.
In the last six.
Yeah. There's going to be a new cast every episode.
Right.
As the last generation of shitty Starks have died and shitty Lannisters. Yeah, I don't know. Drogon's going to be the R2-D2 of the series. He's going to be the only one that's
story.
In all the seasons, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's not what this story is. It's coming to its end. It won't... The story itself is not going to survive a long winter.
No.
So we go over to...
The Double D's don't have enough food to provide George Martin
the writing staff. yeah, so we go over to Dragonstone, and Jon is petting a dragon, and Dany's watching... Then she tells Jon that the dragons are her children, and she killed a bunch of troops, just like Jon did when he was taking back Winterfell. She asks him about the knife and the heart, but Jorah interrupts before he can explain anything.
He knife blocks Jon.
He does, yeah. Jon looks like he was grateful to see Jorah at the beginning. Like, uh-huh. He doesn't want to explain this.
Right. I still question why. What is, like, that's... I mean, I keep falling back to what I said like 2 weeks ago, which is like, if you're trying to tell an incredible story to someone who's barely believing it, you don't want to, like if you pick up to a hitchhiker and they say, I've got a top secret mission, you got to get me to a secret base or humanity's going to be lost. Okay. Uh-huh. Probably reaching for my tire iron. If you start saying the president's out to kill you and that there's a piece of metal embedded in your brain and there's chemtrails and black hot, then the tire iron's definitely coming out.
Yeah.
So I guess it's that, but like I just feel like at this point Danny's convinced, and there's other problems I'll have. We'll talk about that later. But I want to take some time out to praise the show because the Drogon stuff continues to be amazing. Like they've
that
come
stuff is awesome.
So far from Robo Drogon of previous seasons, like when he like buzzes Jon and then wheels around and lands and does that kind of like galloping shimmy run, like it kind of believably like what a giant beast like that would run when it doesn't even have like front feet. It's just got the little bat wings that how utterly convincing it is that Kit Harington's petting this thing.
Yeah.
Like,
no, it looks great.
It's so good that the first time I watched it, my brain didn't even process that I'm watching special effects.
That's the thing about this show. I'm consistently amazed with what they can do given their budget because
just absorbed.
just absorbed.
It's just like you just get wrapped up in the watching it. You don't even realize.
It's impressive to me because I was linked an article by one of my friends about the budgets on this show and how they kind of stack up to other shows. Uh-huh. Apparently, they're averaging about $6 million an episode on this show. That seems extraordinarily low
for
what they're getting out of it. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, from not just the special effects and CG and the pyrotechnics and stuff, but if you look at just the costuming and the landscapes and location shooting, they are really stretching that money, and they're putting it to good use.
Yes,
I have to say, and I'm constantly impressed with Drogon being on the screen for more than a half a second.
Right.
Every time he's up there, because I'm like, that must cost a lot of money, and I don't know how you guys are making the show.
Now, I will say that it's starting to get ridiculous that we haven't seen Ghost.
But
they talk about how that's, that I do, and it's silly that John would go up north to that Ghost, and the fact that they can splash all this money around and set 20 dudes on fire simultaneously, but you can't composite a real wolf into a scene, like it... Maybe if they would sit there and show their budget and walk you through, and they can be like, here's the $100,000 that we had to spend on Ghost, and if we did that, we wouldn't, the Drogon scene would be 3 seconds shorter than it was. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Like I said, it's hard for me to believe that they just can't render the damn wolf when it's such a fan favorite and we haven't seen him he's been missing for going on two seasons now.
Yeah, I guess it's not a favorite to this fan. Like ever since like the last time I cared about Ghost and thought, yeah, Ghost was when he saved Sam and Gilly.
Uh-huh.
Like how many seasons ago? That might've been
amazing.
3 seasons
ago. But like Summer was, went out like a hero. I missed the direwolves. I think they're cool.
I thought the Nymeria reunion scene was good. Yeah. I don't know. I guess that's the question.
Like, would you go Nymeria or would you go a couple scenes of Ghost skulking in the background? I would take Nymeria every single time. So maybe that's the budget, the way it sorts out. But, given that 100 million people are watching this and the merchandising alone, it's just like, sell 1,000 more Game of Thrones t-shirts. Bam. You're done.
Right.
You're done. You got
go. Can have a go- can ghost we, Kickstarter.
Can we have a goat? Yeah, here. This is a t-shirt we are absolutely going to make, a milk carton with a white giant wolf on it. Says, have you seen me? Sell it. Donate all proceeds. No, we'll donate all to our pockets.
Got Ghost?
Yeah, got Ghost. There you go.
I don't know. That sounds real dumb. Sounds like something we'd make.
Hungry for apples. So here's the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
John and Jorah meet for the first time.
Yep.
And Surf Your Father, no mention made of the big honking Valyrian steel blade with the white bear's head on it.
That's not a bear head anymore. It's a wolf head.
I think
Jorah
that's
probably
book.
Doesn't recognize
I think that's
it.
That's something they established in the books and like it's they didn't
no,
actually
think
did they?
Yeah,
the hilt
changed
was destroyed,
it to a wolf,
made it a wolf.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
I'm pretty sure it's a wolf now.
All right.
But I feel like John has a responsibility to at least say, do you want this sword back?
Or for, yeah.
I know he's like a shamed Mormon, but
yeah.
Come on.
There's very little of that coming through.
Yeah.
Like if you're just a person who start watching, there's like the fact that Jorah is a disgraced Mormon. Like that's not... That's not coming
across.
It's
all like, what, 5 seasons ago? Six seasons ago
at
this point.
But I guess it's also fair. It's like, Jamie being an attempted child murderer is not coming through in his character right now either.
Yeah, they've both changed as people.
But I also thought it was weird that there was no mention of Sam. Like, because I thought the whole idea, like, I'm now honestly left wondering why Sam went to the Citadel, since we just saw him left and his main accomplishment is... finding out how many shits, Sept and Maribold took, cutting Gilly off as she was dropping the biggest truth bomb on the series to date, and curing Jorah of Grayscale, which has had no narrative payoff so far.
Not yet.
I thought it would that he'd be like, well, you have an acolyte named Sam to thank, and John. I don't know. Like, there's connections to be made here, and they're not making them.
Maybe the prophecy is about Ajorahai. Are we sure that that's not just like a mistranslation?
Yeah, the unguent is like 90% milk of the poppy, so he's a high for sure. I'm just saying, like, with all the fan service they got going on, there was a lot of fan service left on the table.
Yeah. No, that's true. I would have expected something about the sword.
Yeah.
The other thing that Jorah provides, I guess, assuming he comes back to Dragonstone alive, maybe some military advice? I don't know. This guy's not really a military strategist, though.
Yeah.
But nobody on their team is. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Tyrion really isn't. He's more of a diplomat.
I mean, Jorah, I thought he was going to become, like, Sir Barristan's, Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard.
Right.
I thought that's the natural thing for him to take, because he's got... You know, Danny's not going to marry him and give him what he wants, the queen's booty. So it seems like a logical thing is to, like, take a vow where you're not going to have it, and then you can just serve her chastely from afar. It's so
stupid,
weird.
Stupid grayscale.
Yeah. I don't know. The other thing we're kind of glossing over here is John. This is the third time. We've seen the dragons take an instant liking to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Dany was the first one. Tyrion, when he went into the free Viserion and Rhaegal. And now Jon.
Yeah.
We know that Jon is at least half Targaryen because of what the show has showed us. I think a question can be raised in the minds of viewers is... Is this something special, and is there going to be something made of this?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I just want to know what I mean. It seems like you got three dragons. You got three people with an affinity for dragons.
Uh-huh.
The dragon has three heads. Danny's wearing a three-headed dragon. Like, wow, this seems like a done deal.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Except for
John's
going to try to get himself killed beyond the wall now.
Well, yeah, I doubt that's going to happen. He may be killed, but I don't think he won't be back.
And even if he does get killed, there's someone right in the, there's a medic in the party.
Yeah, there is. I think there has to be some significance to those three, people.
Yeah.
But I think we're yet to see exactly what it is.
Yep.
All right, we go over to Bran at Winterfell. He sends the ravens north over the wall to spy. Apparently he sits in the freezing cold for 24 hours while controlling these things. Maester,
he's lost his connection to humanity, which includes his connection to needing to feel warm,
I guess, and sleeping and eating. Maester Wilkin's conveniently there just as he breaks out. So Maester Wilkin's freezing his butt off too for a full day.
Uh-huh.
He sees the White Walkers, and then he tells the Maester to send ravens. And he's like, we have no ravens left. You sent them all north.
You warged them all.
Right.
Did you see what I was talking about with the rotating crow's eyes?
Yeah, I did.
So it looks like
he's swapping back and forth between them.
Because there's a couple theories people wrote in. My theory was that you're supposed to be impressed by how he is in tandem, like rotating, connecting all these different crows. And the second is that, like, some people thought that, like, he's hiding from the Night's King. Like, this is a decoy strategy.
That might explain better why there are so many.
Yeah, because the Night King looks at the flock and it, like, explodes the flock.
Right.
So, you know, Bran is trying to avoid a situation where the Night King can, like, psychically confront him.
Mm-hmm.
So by swapping bird, the Night King can't quite lock in on him.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good theory, too.
And
it's as much sense as anything else makes.
I'm sure he could have warged into really anything anywhere, right? I mean, I don't think he has to be, like, near a thing to warg into it.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't
know that for sure.
We have a shocking lack of information about how any of this magic works.
Yeah.
Seven seasons in.
I did think it was smart of him, though, to take the flying creatures, because that way Night's King can't repeat last time and grab them. Because
that's the thing. If you can warg from any arbitrary distance, Bran could snag three dragons and see what the Night King thinks about that.
Sure.
Yeah. Try to disperse these guys when you look at them. So that's a hop, skip, and a jump away from there. It really does bother me that this stuff is so ill-defined.
Yeah, I guess... I don't know. I guess it'll bother me if they do something, like, super important with it that stretches my credibility.
Right.
Or stretches the show's credibility, rather.
Right.
But as it sits now, I'm still okay with everything they've done.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I guess they've consistently shown the brand has to be in proximity or touching something, be able to see something, to be able to take it. And that's consistent with all the warging we've seen in the show. Mm-hmm. So if they go and start doing like remote action at a distance, they're going to have to explain that, or they're going to have to show somehow brand learning that technique or powering up somehow, or I don't know, Dragon Ball Z style, grunting and grimacing for 5 minutes as a vortex of energy slowly.
Or at the very least,
lights him, turns his hair blonde and levitates it.
Using it in a way that isn't completely pivotal to the plot at first.
Okay.
So that we can get used to it and then know that that's an ability. And then, you know, if he were to just like warg into Cersei or something and throw her off of the Red Keep, that'd be fucking stupid. But, you know, if he were able to. Well, not that I wouldn't like to see it, but I don't know. I think there are ways that you can kind of. Not necessarily like explain or show him Rocky style montaging his way into it, and still make it not completely unbelievable.
That's what he does. He's going to warg into Cersei. She's going to go to Jaime with wide eyes, tell him I faked every orgasm. This is your fault, and then throw herself off to toss him far the Red Keep.
Just for fun. That's just Brand's Tuesday morning.
That's just what he does for breakfast. he dines on the misery of Lannisters now. all right.
Yeah, maybe we should move on to Sam.
Oh, but I will say that, like, I actually kind of think the fact that he remote controlled these crows half a continent away across the wall.
Yeah.
And they also, for the very first time, we got a bit of the gauge of the distance the White Walkers are from Eastwatch. It was a not inconsiderable distance.
Yeah.
Like, there's a montage of him getting to Eastwatch, going over Eastwatch, and going over varied terrain and lots of cuts until we got to the Army of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. Still ways off.
Which also seems like they're rolling hella deep. So I'm really interested in seeing how John picks off one of these guys and comes takes him with him.
Right.
So
sneaks up and grabs one who's taking a shit in the woods.
Yeah.
There were also some really nice angles of Winterfell that you don't see a lot in this scene. I actually appreciated those. Then we move on to Sam, who's filing scrolls. I don't know. He's gathering scrolls from a very sensitive location. He overhears the maesters talking about a message from Bran about the White Walkers. And he tries to convince him to do something about it, which he says basically set the maesters reading all the scrolls to find out how to defeat them and get the armies moving north. But they just make fun of him and say, yeah, we'll consider it.
Yeah.
And when Sam leaves, the maester says he hasn't told Sam about his father and brother yet.
Good thing they weren't discussing that, Raven.
Yeah, no.
He said, news of some Tarly that was burnt to a... Sam, you might want to go check the latrines.
Like, first of all, I wonder what Sam would think. Like, Sam seems like maybe him and his brother would be okay if it wasn't for his dad being a dick. But, like, would he really care about his dad getting burnt to a crisp, being a pig-headed idiot?
I doubt it.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
I know a bit about estranged parents and, you know.
Mine was not nearly the dick that Randall was.
Right. So I don't know. I don't know what they would what he would think about that. It seems unlikely that he'd have a big emotional reaction to it, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows? I also thought, I wonder, because as I said, it's phenomenally stupid, the idea that they can parade this white in front of Cersei and her be like, oh my God, I'm suddenly taking you seriously and I'm on your side now.
Mm-hmm.
Sam outlines a case where what if, and the fact that he's leaving, where do you think he's going? I'm asking these are a lot of disjointed questions because I'm piecing this
question.
Together.
Where is Sam going?
Because I think there's like the logical thing to do would be bring the white to Old Town.
Okay.
Show the maesters, here is a dead man walking.
Uh-huh.
This is what we are seeing. And, you know, you could even have, I don't know, you could even have Bran do a crow warging demonstration or something. Like, I don't think for nothing Sam lays out the very real fact that the maesters are this respected organization by everyone. The commoners respect their education and learning. The lords respect the fact that they can communicate swiftly and their allegiance is to the realm and not to individual lordships. Like, they are respected. They're respected everywhere. So if you could get them on the same message that this is a real thing, that is a non-ridiculous way for this end game to go forward. In which case, that's super frustrating because it feels like if they shifted these events around a couple times, like John or Tyrion could make a decision that's out of wisdom rather than seemingly just a last-ditch Hail Mary, like, fuck it, let's try it. We haven't tried showing Cersei a dead man, so...
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I just don't think it would matter to Cersei.
I know.
That's my final thing. My final thought on the matter is, like, Cersei doesn't care.
No.
Cersei knows that when it comes down to it, her enemies are going to be stuck between her and the White Walkers.
Right.
And they have to fight regardless.
Right.
So wait for them to fight, wait for them to be killed, and then she'll deal with the threats.
Yeah, and
from a much stronger position.
And again, most of Dany's inner council knows this. Like, Tyrion and Varys should know all this. So that's what I'm saying, that they pivoted to the Maesters, they'd have something, because if you appealed directly to the Lords and said...
Right.
Regardless of what Cersei's saying, this is the thing that needs to be done. I kind of think that has at least a prayer of working. Mm-hmm. We're just appealing to Cersei's better nature.
Right.
The fact that Tyrion is suggesting it is like, I got a lot of feedback saying like, well, maybe this is proof that Tyrion is going to betray Dany because this is such obviously bad counsel. It's going to get Jon killed. That's not good when your viewers are taking that message away.
Right.
I don't think. Unless they actually intend Tyrion to be a betrayer.
Well, he's certainly in this next scene trying to justify Dany's actions to Varys. And probably more importantly, himself. Varys says he told himself the same things that Tyrion's saying when he watched the Mad King's victims get burned.
Right.
And Tyrion needs to make her listen somehow. Oh, also there's a message from Winterfell for Jon. And I really love this scene, the way that they present this message. Uh-huh. It's got this sealed scroll. Oh, well,
this is for the King of the North.
Yeah, of course. I wouldn't open it. But
so what's it say? Nothing good.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, why is it Tyrion's job to make her listen?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's weird that Varys is kind of washing his hands here.
He's very hands-off.
Especially since he promised Dany that if he had a problem with her management, that he would take it right to her.
Right.
So, like, that's another curious moment that they, like, you know, we universally praise that, like, you know, real talk they had a couple episodes. And here now, it's like Tyrion, it's like Varys is like, yeah, you done fucked up, kid.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? What's going on today? What's going on with the Mad Queen you got growing here? Like, it's your problem too, man.
Yeah, it makes me question his motivations, honestly.
Where's your fucking intelligence? Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't be in this situation if you had told me to Euron and my sister address. You know, it's like, it's weird because, like, all these obviously smart characters are having what I would consider dumb conversations.
But a lot of people are, you know, questioning Varys' motives. Is he actually working for Dany? Is he giving information to the Lannisters somehow?
But here's
I think it's scenes like this and this sort of inconsistency that, you know, lends some credence to those ideas.
I think you're right, and maybe that's the whole thing, though. The reason that he's being weirdly written is to keep us kind of on that will he, won't he betray Dany kind of edge.
Maybe.
But if you take him at his word, you know, Danny's still the obvious choice for the best, you know, new management for the realm. And if you don't take him at his word, then what the hell is his game?
Yeah.
He overthrew
this
previous administration that he was as high as he could ever get. Like, does Varys have desires for the Iron Throne himself, the foreign-born eunuch?
He says he doesn't.
I mean, even if he did, he's got, like, nothing really makes sense other than him being in service to the realm, and the show has done nothing to show that a smart person like Varys would start suddenly doubting the queen over Cersei.
Yeah.
It'd be one thing if somehow Gendry had won, you know, risen from the Streets of Steel to the Red Keep, and he's like, oh, well, you know, now we got this person, maybe I'll back this other guy, but it's still Cersei fucking Lannister.
Yeah. All right, we move on to Dany's team talking strategy and deciding on a plan to prove to Cersei once and for all that the White Walkers exist by going north, capturing one, and presenting it to her in King's Landing.
I love this
is ridiculous.
I love how they gloss over, like the hard part is actually getting a meeting with Cersei. I mean,
there were two very, very hard parts to this.
Yes, going up north and getting the loan, like you said, the white that's taking a shit.
And there are only two parts to this plan, so they're both very, very hard.
Yeah, like even the underpants gnomes in South Park had 2 points. Like, this is just all literally question mark, question mark, question mark.
Yeah.
result question mark. Like, it's what the hell? What the hell?
Yeah.
I've got in my notes, this is such bullshit. I don't know. And again, that's another thing. It's like, here's a fair question that was propounded to me dozens of times in the feedback. How the hell does Tyrion know Jaime's alive? From Tyrion's perspective, he saw a gout of flame aimed at his brother,
yep.
Bronn tackle him into the water, and neither of them surface.
Yeah. He probably doesn't know that for sure.
But he just confidently asserts that, oh, and I need to get in contact with Jaime.
Jaime will listen to me,
Like, that's something that's, like, a really low-key... Like, I didn't even notice that's a second viewing. It's like, how the hell does he even know that his brother's alive? If he does know his brother's alive, did he withhold information from Dany? Like, hey, there's my brother, commander of the Lannister army, sneaking off with the sellsword, who's his bodyguard.
Uh-huh.
Like, might want to round him up, your grace. Yeah.
Well, it's tough to know how much time has taken place between that battle and this moment.
Yeah.
Potentially Varys is doing his job and has intel and knows that he's alive.
Right.
But we're not given any indication that that's the case.
Right.
So.
I did like the whole "I don't need your permission with respect, your grace. I'm a king, and I trusted you to come down here, and now it's your turn to trust me."
Mm-hmm.
That stuff is pretty good. It's just that's the thing. Like, as good as these episodes are, the central framing device of the season, which is trying to go north to get this white, is just really, really dumb. Like, not even from a meta level. Like, oh, there's just no way they can get a White Walker. This is stupid. But just the end result to convince Cersei, that is also dumb. And no one is. I mean, they're paying lip service to it. It's like they're raising all the same objections. But like, I feel like there's enough objections in the room that like the result would be they have to sit down and make another plan, not just be like, well, this is the shittiest plan we thought of in 30 seconds. Let's execute. Mm-hmm. Go team. It's like literally like the way they framed it, like Tyrion's like musing like, what if we do, like, okay, well, what if?
Yeah, no, this is exact. I mean, this is Ocean's 11, 12, 13. This is every heist movie you've ever seen where they come up with a plan that couldn't possibly work. And then everybody steps forward to say, I have a piece of the puzzle.
Yes.
Oh, I have a piece of the puzzle too. And yet somehow there are like five pieces of the puzzle missing and they just ignore that and continue with the plan here.
That's the thing. Like, George Clooney had a fully rendered wireframe diagram of the Bellagio's bank vault.
Uh-huh.
If Tyrion had that, fine. Okay, let's go.
Yeah.
The Night King uses a pressure mounted sin in his bedroom chamber where he keeps his prized white. And, you know, it's like, no, there's none of that. There's none of that.
No, there's not.
Yeah.
Just a hunch. So I like this. I'm going to credit Red Lancer from the forums because I was reading through and he said that the white they bring back might actually be Benjen.
Oh.
Which I think is interesting, but I don't know if it's all that convincing because Benjen still kind of looks and acts like a human.
That's
right?
What I'm saying. Like, he's not the white that would inspire fear into the lords.
I wouldn't think so.
Like,
no.
The snarling, mindless beast. And the other thing is, like, can Jon not mention the fact that the white that he saw, like, played possum for an extended period of time and reactivated? Like, what happened? Like, it seems like if this even
this is
works,
be a Toy Story situation.
It's going to be like I saw on Reddit. It's a Michigan J. Frog situation where John's going to have this white that's snarling and out for blood, and he shows him to Cersei, and it just collapses on the floor dead.
Yeah.
Then he gets up, as soon as everybody leaves the Red Keep, and it's just him and John. He puts on the top hat. Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. And it's like, why? That's a perfectly logical thing to ask. Yeah. The Night King controls these guys. He can make them play dead. He's done it before. John, you saw this. What the fuck?
Yeah. No, I will go out on a limb here and say they haven't really thought about this plan very much.
Is this something for us to do? It's something fun, getting the gang all back together.
Got to do something.
Yeah.
Let's make everybody feel like they're doing something.
Yeah.
All right. The Lords of the North are pissed about John taking so long to get back, and they want Sansa to lead him. Sansa assures that he'll return, and things will be awesome once again. Arya watches a weird expression on her face, which I couldn't quite read. Afterward, Arya insinuates that Sansa's only concerned with being a fancy ruling lady, and Sansa says she's not cutting the heads off of people because she doesn't think it's a good leadership philosophy. A lot going on in this scene.
No, I've got a different opinion on this, Jim. I've come around to thinking that maybe we are actually seeing a one-sided ploy. that this is Arya and Sansa, in fact, working together to out Littlefinger's true loyalties. Okay. So they can expose him in front of the lords as the betrayer. Because anything else makes Sansa or Arya look really stupid and reactionary. Mm-hmm. Like they are little girls who haven't been through 5 years of hell and are ready to turn on each other at a moment's notice over childhood grievances about you liking pretty things. Mm-hmm. Like, what's Sansa supposed to do? Fucking sleep in the ruined tower because this is mom and dad's room? She's the Lady of Winterfell. This is where she belongs. Jesus Christ, Arya.
Well, I'm trying to figure out if, like, this whole beheading thing is Arya's true philosophy on the matter or if she's testing Sansa.
Yeah.
To see what kind of leader she's going to be. I really don't know.
Yeah. It's and the other thing is, like, this also this also is of a piece, like, when, you know, everybody's like, what is Littlefinger's deal? And Sansa's like, I know what Littlefinger wants. Like, it'd be a pretty brilliant way to get us all, like, thinking that this is just going to be a betrayal by Arya / Sansa, and then it turns out it's just going to be their way of trapping Littlefinger mm-hmm. into some kind of hard candy situation, which I fully support. But as it, and it, it's just, it almost, this is one thing where I'm giving double D's a benefit of the doubt. Like it's dumb, but it also might be that intentionally. Mm-hmm. Now there's a fine line to straddle there, right? Because you can get the situation where the dumb plan makes everyone look Littlefinger looks stupid for getting caught in it. Arya and Sansa look stupid for, you know, like there's a thin line between, you know, playing into audience's expectations of like these characters' worst moments, like, oh, well, this is Arya and them being stupid kids again, and then they're going to do something brilliant, but they got to be able to pull that off without making Littlefinger look stupid, mm-hmm. because that's the thing, you cannot suddenly make Littlefinger be dumb so that they can get the best of them.
Yeah, I mean, you have to play off somebody's other weaknesses, right?
Right.
It can't be their stupidity because none of these characters are stupid.
Right.
It has to be, like, for Ned Stark, it was honor, right?
And
I think
it's fair to say that Sansa used to be stupid.
Sure, yeah.
Like
she's,
she said,
she's
like,
grown a lot over
she's
these
saying,
seven
said
years.
Herself, like, I was just a stupid girl who's always wrong, but you've had many seasons of development past that. So,
right.
Like, I no longer think you're dumb, Sansa. Don't prove me wrong.
Yeah, and you are very familiar with Littlefinger's machinations, so...
Yes.
Yeah, they need to play off something else. Littlefinger's own hubris, I think, might
right.
also be a possibility.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't have to be dumb to be fooled. He could be too full of himself.
I actually was kind of, in my subsequent watches, somewhat impressed with the idea that we thought Littlefinger was freaking out because there's something incriminating him,
mm-hmm.
but what he actually found was something we know in the show is horribly incriminating from a Sansa perspective. And you think of Arya... the last time she saw Sansa before this, she was standing right on the stage next to Joffrey smiling, and then Jorah grabbed her and said, don't look, and her head, dad's head got cut off. So mm-hmm. she sees this, and she sees this message, you know, that's the thing, like, if I'm right about this plot, it's entirely possible that Arya doesn't know she's being played either, that this is something
sure.
that Sansa's little fingering, and it's going to, and then how is she going to convince Arya that she's actually... I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Littlefinger is definitely playing it like it's something he's doing for Sansa, right? Hiding this message that she
right.
sent so that no one will know.
But that's the other tricky thing, is to show something like a machination from the audience perspective. Because, like, when I was watching this first time, like, Littlefinger comes out of the room and Arya immediately steps out of the shadows... and starts loudly jacking with this door.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, my first thought is like, well, realistically, wouldn't you wait a couple minutes to make sure Littlefinger didn't forget his keys? Then like, oh, I left my wallet in my chamber. Like, go back. Like, you know, the fact that Arya is this master sneak assassin thief kind of person. She's also living lie detector.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of her faceless man training.
It was.
If this is just happening as it's just nakedly happening on the show, where she's just falling for all these traps and tricks, it just really seems dumb. That's all I want to say.
Okay. Let's go to Davos and Tyrion at King's Landing. Bronn leads Jaime down to the catacombs where Tyrion meets with him and tells him they can't win the war and Dany wants something super important that is not bending the knee. And we don't find out what it is in this scene, but of course we know it's an armistice. I think when, you know, he's talking about the dragons and how Dany's going to win the war, Jaime knows that. Jaime's mm-hmm. seen the devastation of the dragons, mm-hmm. and so it really hits home with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's a little more open, you know, than someone who hasn't seen the dragon devastation would be
yeah.
to this proposal. But I wish this scene had been longer. I wish this scene had a little more room to breathe.
Agreed.
And these two brothers
This
could.
Is a big moment.
Yeah, it should be. It should be a huge moment. And with what they're given, I think these two actors do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wish they were given a little bit more
yeah.
to work with.
No, Nikolai, like his... when you see the tension literally leave his body after Tyrion makes the, well, with that training sword, it'll take you a while to cut me in half.
Uh-huh.
Like that, like he is carrying a lot of weight of the script just by this performance. This is like... Jaime wants to fall back into this relationship with his brother, where mm-hmm. he's the naughty little boy, and Jamie's the slightly more responsible older brother that looks after him and makes sure he's supplied with drinks and whores, and that's all a good time. And Jaime misses that, and that is all completely unsaid except for his performance and our knowledge of the characters.
Sure.
Also, by the way, we glossed over the arrival of. Davos and Tyrion and King's Landing. A lot of people are like, oh, Master Smuggler just rides a canoe up to the beach of King's I mean, no, the Master Smuggler is the fact that he knows how to bribe the guards and he mm-hmm. knows how to have the crab meat, the subterfuge. Like, that's...
Yeah. He was prepared.
Yeah, it's the whole package. It's not just where you land. It's not just all that. And also, like, there's a lot of these snide remarks about the Double D's they don't remember anything from the previous seasons. How can you watch this season and think that?
Uh-huh.
Like Tyrion's like, oh, the last time I was at King's Landing, I killed my father. And Davos immediately shots back, last time I was here, you burnt my son with wildfire.
Uh-huh.
Like, of course they got this institutional memory of their show.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Like, to me, it seems obvious that the real problem is they are trying to tell a story that they don't themselves fully understand.
And they're strapped for time.
Yeah. The other thing I want to talk about that is that knowing that Tyrion's chief strategy was burning men alive when it was the survival of his side, it is a little bit hypocritical to show him so disgusted with Dany burning people alive
yeah.
for the same situation.
Yeah, they're both armies. They're both groups of troops, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know why when he's protecting King's Landing, it's somehow noble.
Yeah.
And when Dany's doing it, it's somehow not.
I wish there was a conversation with him with Varys. It's like, look, you don't have to tell me, Varys. I know what it's like to burn thousands of men alive because, I had my fill of it. Like, mm-hmm. These aren't fatal flaws. They could be easily fixed. But then again, every single time you say that, that adds 30 seconds of runtime, and what are you going to do?
So, continuing their little scheme here, Davos goes to Flea Bottom in search of Gendry. When he finds him, he asks him to come to Dragonstone, and Gendry is basically already in the boat.
Yep.
On the way out, he grabs his warhammer. When they reach the escape boat, some gold cloaks find him. Davos smoothly bribes them, and they leave. And it works until Tyrion shows up. They recognize him, and they're going to take him captive, but Gendry blasts him in the head with a warhammer.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been talking about Gendry on and off for the last... I don't know, 6 seasons?
Mostly as a joke.
Five seasons?
I believe 2-3 episodes ago, I said just Gendry's never coming back.
Yeah.
which, of course, I did.
Of course. And, of course, he shows up 2 episodes later.
I have a long track record of saying, oh, cold hands, binging, forget, get the fuck over it. And then 2 episodes right. later, the dude shows up. So.
Yeah, yeah. So what is the purpose, I guess, of bringing Gendry back at this point? Is it to... sort of in a weird way loop this series back on itself with the Ned-Robert relationship?
Well, here's a curveball.
Mm-hmm.
This whole scene is about your dad and my dad are bros. It's a lie. Jon's dad isn't Ned Stark.
Well...
Gendry's dad caved
from
in Jon's
point of
John's
view.
Dad's chest at the Trident.
From a certain point of view, I'm,
yeah,
I'm gonna Obi-Wan
yeah.
you here.
Yeah,
but.
No, but I'm saying if Rhaegar's Force Ghost was in the back, he'd look like the painting of the Scream. Like,
right.
no, we were not bros. I felt like that, and maybe that's maybe that's something the show knows as well, and it's going to show that, like, you know, because there's still some betrayals and backstabbings and tragedy happening, and maybe, like, Gendry, he's all like, your grace this and your grace that, but maybe Gendry will start hearing the call of the throne of people, the right people flatter him. I mean, there's not a lot of time left for that kind of stuff, but
yeah.
It also gave me pause because I've been thinking, you know, I used a show to kind of like set my book expectations as well. And then, like, you know, Gendry had kind of gone off my radar, kind of like Euron. And I'm like, well, maybe Gendry is actually going to be a lot more important to the plot. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you'd look at the first couple seasons, the first couple books of Game of Thrones, you'd think, well, Gendry's going to be super important. And then, like, his importance trails off and sort of both. But I don't know. He's hanging around, and now he's right there with Jon with his Warhammer north of the wall. I didn't see that coming.
No, that was fairly unexpected. And I think most of this, it certainly works as fan service. I mean, I think everybody was happy to see Davos essentially wink to the camera.
Yes.
And say, hey, I thought you'd still be rowing.
Nobody.
It was great.
Nobody,
I loved it.
Nobody didn't like seeing Bobby B's son pick up a giant-ass Warhammer and bash two gold cloaks in the face. That was all good stuff.
Yep, for sure. But it makes me question, like, what is Gendry's larger role? And I just don't have a great answer for it yet.
Yeah, me either. Because it seems like he isn't special at all. He's not trained as a warrior. He's just, I mean, there's symbolically it's interesting. But yeah, plot-wise, how does it work out? Don't know.
Yeah, this is probably the best episode in, or the best scene in this episode for me. I really like watching Davos do his thing.
Yeah, Davos is very good.
He's super smooth. And the actor, Liam Cunningham, I think his name is, just, he's great at this character. Like, he's
kind of like becoming the Tyrion of the second half of the series.
Hmm.
Like, as much as I like Tyrion going into the first, like, Tyrion's kind of taking a back seat, and Davos is the guy that stepped up, and he's the people's Tyrion.
And he's making the things happen, right? He's the one uniting the North, essentially.
Yeah.
John rolls in and says, follow me, and they say no, and Davos says, here's why you should follow this guy.
Yeah, and what do I know? I've only lived to a ripe old age, unlike you shits.
Right.
I also like the fact that they keep emphasizing how he is not combat capable and a liability.
Yeah.
Almost exactly the same way that they did with Sam in the early goings, and I'm wondering if, like, I'm just counting down to, like, Chekhov's Davos badassery.
He's
going to have to, like, dig deep and do something, because else, where is all this going? Like, they keep hammering at home that, like, I'm shit in a fight. I can't help you. I'm shit in a fight. I can't help you. Like, either he's just going to die because he's shit in a fight, or he's going to get something done.
He might. And his line about how you'd better hurry to your favorite establishment or you put a hole in that chainmail. That was one of the highlights of the scene for me. Move on to Jaime going to see Cersei. He tells her, hey, I met with Tyrion, who said that an army of dead men are marching on the Seven Kingdoms, and Dany wants an armistice. Cersei asks if he's going to punish Bronn for setting up the meeting that she knew all about, and then tells Jaime that a meeting with Dany could be in their best interest. And, oh, by the way, she reveals she's also pregnant with what she's going to say is his baby.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it is. It probably is, given what we've seen on screen, but I'm not even sure she's 100% or 100% sure that she is pregnant.
I was going to say, she's either 100% pregnant or she's not.
Right, or 0%.
Yeah. No, I feel you. And there's a lot of people call. There's a lot of feedback about this. For people that don't like listening to feedback, there's essentially three camps. One, she's pregnant, and what does that mean to the series? Two, she is deceiving Jaime for some to manipulate him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's 3 points. Three, this puts a clock, like the jetpacking, the time passage. Like, when you got a woman pregnant, I don't know how it works in Westeros, but here it's like, you know, you got three trimesters and boom, it's here. And there's, like, gradually changing to the body conditions.
This is the fabled long pregnancy.
Yeah, so
it's going to last generations.
Right? Yeah. They build a wall in Cersei's uterus to keep it from coming out. They got to be careful here because there's a clock now. Like, they can't just be zipping back and forth over Westeros and that this particular passage of time not be reflected in Cersei's character.
Right.
So it's kind of a daring move.
And that might even be part of the plot, you know, if she doesn't start showing and we're you know, 6 months down the road, Jamie's going to be like, what the hell?
Right.
Although, what's going on here?
They do, you know, they had a similar clock with Gilly's baby.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Sam himself says that Bran survived for multiple years beyond the wall when he brought Gilly with a newborn. And now, although I did notice that it seems like baby Sam's a little bit older now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe he's two-ish.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe.
It's tough to say.
It's tough to say.
I don't know.
Like I said, maybe it would be the mythical long pregnancy.
Yeah. And then
spiders everywhere.
At the end, she tells Jamie, never betray me again, which is pretty ominous. And it almost makes me wonder if Cersei might not kill Jamie. Like, we've been talking about, like, will Jamie be the person to kill Cersei, you know? Mm. And there's been so much focus on that. Wouldn't it be an odd twist of fate if she were to kill him? Someone who's remained loyal to her from the very beginning,
right,
all the way to the end, and yet she's forced to kill him,
right,
for some reason.
Another thing to would it be dramatically satisfying if this baby kills her?
Huh.
I mean, she mentions that she's 40 years, like, because she said that for 40 years I listened to father. They've talked about the fact that her and Jamie are all both slightly over childbearing age. Is it possible? Like, there's a lot of the older you wait to have children, there's more complications. This isn't a modern society.
Right.
You know, Qyburn said, like, you know, do you want me to give you something? Because they do have an effective abortificant in Westeros called Moon Tea. I wonder if would that be satisfying if she dies in child. Like, to me, no, it wouldn't be satisfying.
Yeah, I want her to die screaming like she wished on Olenna.
The other question is, does this fuck up Maggie's prophecy? Because she said she's prophesied to have three children. Now, that was three children with the king. So I guess they got all kinds of wiggle room in this prophecy.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, we also... Well, but the thing is that it wasn't with the king. They said the king will have this and you'll have this many.
Oh, right.
And you already had a child that died young, so the prophecy's kind of already busted. Like, yeah, I don't know. You technically had five children, but we're only going to count three because they had gold hair. I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure.
But it's the kind of, like, quasi-thought out. I mean, this just came out of nowhere.
It did.
Like, this is the thing I most instantly hated about the episode.
Well, it's why it makes me think she's using this as a control mechanism.
Right.
As opposed to actually being pregnant.
But why?
Because
she's
the
unquestioned queen of Westeros. Like, if she wants to manipulate Jamie, like, I don't know why she thinks she needs to do this to manipulate Jamie. Or give him, maybe to give him something to fight for, because she senses that he's about ready to give up because of the dragons. Well, now you got a kid.
Yeah. I mean,
dynasty is back on the table.
Right. Yeah, that's very much how I viewed it.
Okay.
We'll see what Jamie thinks. So Davos tells Gendry not to reveal his true identity to Jon, which he immediately does upon meeting him. In just a couple of insults traded, Gendry and Jon become instant besties. Gendry asks Jon to take him to Eastwatch, and Davos is annoyed at everyone.
Yep.
So let's talk about Tyrion taking a couple of jabs, I guess, at Jorah, and then giving him this coin that the slaver paid him.
Right.
I thought that was a nice moment between the two of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's sort of like, oh, you remember this, you asshole, when you kidnapped me and got us both sold into slavery.
Right.
Hey, we got through it.
Good times.
And, you know, we're better for it, and I hope you come back.
Right.
It was a nice moment.
Then Jorah kisses Dany's hand, and then...
Yeah.
Jorah has some... What's Jorah thinking about Jon? Because the thing is, I can't take a Jorah-Dany relationship seriously at this point. I don't think he takes it seriously, but it's got to be painful to watch your young queen fall in love with this handsome young king.
For sure.
And you're just a disgraced Mormont from Bear Island.
Just because he knows it's not actually going to happen doesn't mean he doesn't still want it to happen between him and Dany. So, yeah, he's probably fairly uncomfortable about the whole thing.
Right.
And then Jon packs up all the dragon glass and heads off to Eastwatch in a boat.
He should talk to Jaime about advice for ignoring sounds coming from the king and queen's bedroom chambers while you're standing guard in the king / queen's guard.
Right.
They could probably have a long conversation about all that.
Then we move on to Gilly reading a book while Sam studies. She's telling him all these facts from a book, from the book, and comes across a record of Rhaegar's annulment.
Rhaegar.
Hagar's annulment.
I love in the subtitles for it, it said Prince, in quotation marks, Rhaegar. just so you know, in case you missed the irony of her mispronouncing Rhaegar.
I did miss it. What are you talking about?
Well, she's pronounced a ragger, like it's like horribly mispronounced, and it's spelled in the subtitles as R-A-G-G-E-R, but we're supposed to understand that it's Prince Rhaegar.
Sure, yeah.
Targaryen, getting an annulment from his first wife, Elia, and presumably marrying Lyanna Stark in secret in Dorne.
Yeah.
So one of the big questions in Game of Thrones history is, how did that all work? Like, is Jon still technically a bastard because it wasn't a proper marriage? And one of the theories was that he, either got a second marriage consecrated by a septon or whatever, or and it seems like that's what he did.
Yeah, and it was also a question of was Ilyana, is that her name?
Elia? The princess?
Jesus, I can never remember their names.
It's tough.
Because they're not actual characters. If I don't see their face, it's tough.
Yeah.
There was also the question of whether Elia did it willingly, right?
Like, it doesn't seem
whether
like
she
it.
Loved Rhaegar.
Like the way Sam describes the annulment is when a lord sets aside his lady. Like, it does feel like a jilting, which is a bit more brutal than I've always pictured it.
I'm thinking of the Stark counterpart.
Okay, Lyanna.
Okay, Lyanna, yes.
Okay.
Like, was that willing? Was she kidnapped? Was she raped? Like, none of that seems to be true based on this story.
Yeah.
It seems like they got married.
Yeah.
And she was probably on board with that.
Right. No. I'd settled in my mind that, like, there's no way that she, yeah. Like,
but there was nothing to tell us that, right? Like, all the characters assumed that she was drug off screaming by Rhaegar, but it doesn't appear to be that way.
Right.
So Sam, instead of recognizing the importance of what she's saying, he gets testy and he shuts down the whole conversation. He decides he's had enough. He gathers as many of the restricted texts as he can carry in a little satchel, takes Gilly and Lil Sam and rides off in a horse-drawn wagon.
Mm-hmm. One last longing look at the library.
Yeah, so is he just grabbing books at random? Does he know what books he wants to read on the way?
Got a lot of feedback. I think that they were deliberately showing that he was selective in what he's stealing because these are the things that he thinks are probably the most likely to be fruitful.
But then he takes that long look up at the fullness of the library.
All right.
Which to me is saying, what if I missed something?
See, to me,
and yet he still decides to leave.
To me, it's saying my dream was to become a maester, and I'm giving this up in service for something, and I'm taking one last longing look at all these fucking books.
He clearly hasn't found what he's looking for yet, so how could he know that it isn't out there in one of the books
episodes,
he doesn't take?
Man. No, I mean, this is
the problem.
It seems dangerous.
He's leaving the center
of
knowledge.
He's flouncing off because the maesters won't take him seriously, and he is permanently depriving himself from further research of this unprecedented collection of books. So it.
Right, and he clearly has no problem getting his hands on the books at night, right?
Yeah.
So continue with what you've been doing, which is searching the text at night.
I thought him leaving the restricted area unlocked was a pretty cheeky move.
Did he?
Yeah, that's fucking absolute savage. Just like some slack-jawed yokel is going to wander into the restricted section tomorrow, and now what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he intended to do that. Like, I'm going to leave it unlocked so all the other acolytes can get in here and, like, run rampant through it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
it's like a symbolic gesture.
But cinematically, they were saying that he was selectively, and we're going so that later when he has the perfect tome that he needs, it's not going to seem like bullshit. That he was selectively grabbing these particular texts from all over the library because he thinks – doesn't have time to read them all, but he thinks these are the ones that are most fruitful in a search.
Yeah.
Don't know how that works, but it's literally not even in my top five problems with the script.
Sure. Okay, Arya spies on Littlefinger as he gathers info and speaks to the lords of the various houses. The Maester Walken gives Littlefinger a message from Luwyn's records. When he leaves, Arya breaks into his room and finds the Raven message from Sansa about Robb's death, trying to convince to try and convince him to surrender. As she sneaks off with that info, Littlefinger watches from the shadows with satisfaction.
Again, Arya, living lie detector. Master thief and assassin. I don't think Littlefinger might out gather information, but I don't think he's going to out skulk her.
Yeah.
So that's my thesis for this being some kind of grand Stark conspiracy that the two girls are perpetrating upon Littlefinger.
Yeah. So given like the movements of these two characters, Arya and Jon, over the last few episodes, and how they conspicuously, you know, say, "Hey, you thought, what'll John think when he sees you if he really likes seeing me?" It makes me wonder if they're actually going to be reunited at Winterfell, because John's out traipsing around looking
John's
for walkers.
John's not making it back.
He's not coming back anytime
this
soon.
This season, like, right. It seems to me that the arc is going to end up north.
Yeah. Now, it could, I guess. They both ultimately want to get to the same place, right? John wants to present this White Walker, this White to Cersei Lannister in mm-hmm. King's Landing. Mm-hmm. Arya wants to go to King's Landing to kill Cersei Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe the reunion could happen there, potentially, but I'm not sure how that would go down. Certainly, I don't think they'd have the time or the space to sort of hug it out.
Yeah, the other thing I'm increasingly not understanding is why Dany just doesn't take, like, it seems to me that Dany believes Jon now.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about existential threats, Cersei Lannister is not an existential threat now. Like, she's going to probably be behind King's Landing until you go and drag her out of there. Like, this whole idea that, like, if Dany goes up north, Cersei's going to go running buck wild and take over all of the Seven Kingdoms again, that seems crazy. And it also just, you know, like, they got a pretty good reason to put the dragons in a cage, because if you take them against King's Landing and melt the whole city, then congratulations, you're a genocidal maniac.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't she take her dragons up north to to at least lay eyes on the White Walkers?
Yeah.
Also, Bran has established that they're all in one giant group. Like, do they have ice scorpions? Or if they have just bows and arrows, they're not going to do dick all to those dragons. And I don't know. Like, I just wonder that there seems like a bunch of artificial barriers to this. Like as quickly as it's moving, they're also dragging their feet somehow with the dragons. The dragons are dragging their feet.
Yeah, dragons are, you know, they open a lot of doors that the show can't, you know, can't close enough.
But who's going to open the window?
Bran will.
And then he'll jump off it.
Yeah. So Jon arrives at Eastwatch and he tells Tormund the plan to snatch a white. Tormund thinks it's fucking stupid because it is.
Yep.
But there are some people who want to join them. He takes them to the cells where the Hound, Beric, Thoros are all being held. Gendry says not to trust him because they sold him to the Red Witch. Jon thinks it's smart to trust them because they're still breathing and they all go north of the wall together.
Mm-hmm.
Jon's doomed if breathing is the only prerequisite of being trustworthy, because Cersei's breathing.
Well, I mean, he's not wrong. Like, this is essentially the postulate of the noted scholar Rick Grimes, where it's all white meat or dark meat now, you know?
Yeah.
Which kind of sounds vaguely racist, if you just say it like that.
Is that what he says?
Yeah, he says that before he almost throws Merle off the roof in season one. Before he eats a whole chicken. Yep. He only eats the breast, and he did the thighs and the leg.
Because he's racist. He grew up in Georgia. Do you want?
He's fleshist. Yeah. So, I don't even know. But that's like, he's not wrong. Like, when you're fighting the army of the dead, everyone is breathing should be your ally.
Yeah.
But I don't know if Cersei knows that.
Sure.
And even if you drop a white right in her lap, I don't think she's going to try to figure out how to use it to her own advantage.
Mm-hmm. There's some good stuff from Tormund here when he asks who he brought with him, the big woman. Did you bring her with you?
Do you follow, I don't forget this guy's actor on Twitter, but he's been sending a bunch of @replies to Gwendolyn Christie that have like GIFs, different animated GIFs with Tormund and Brienne's face pasted on them. It's pretty entertaining.
That's pretty good. How's Gwendolyn responding?
Pretty good. Also, he also found I think it was a Tormund action figure with the Brienne of Tarth action figure, and he was making him kiss and stuff. Yeah, it's I don't know. I feel like they're all. I mean, I think it's cute. I think it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wouldn't be funny if like Tormund was much larger, but since like I fully believe that Brienne, if she wanted, could cave in his face at any time. It kind of reduces it to like a schoolyard, like pulling on pigtail situation. It reads as cute to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't if it was all capable for him to threaten Brienne. But since he can't, it's more of her discomfort of it. And the fact that, like, I don't even know if it's a discomfort. It's just the fact that she's never had like a relationship where, you know, she's been the one that pines, but she's never been on this end where she's been an object of desire and she's not quite sure what to feel about it. I don't think she just is not interested. It's just like this is a foreign concept to her.
Yeah.
So I'm sure everyone loves hearing the 40-year-old man's opinions on the inner thoughts of the warrior woman, but that's my read of it.
Yeah, that's what the show has told us, I think.
Yeah.
And that's it for the episode. We ran a little bit long here on the recap.
It's tough.
I don't think it was like a super long episode. I think it was just a lot to talk about.
Yeah. It's also like, you know, again, a lot was made about the Seven Samurai, the Magnificent Seven, the Suicide Squad. It was cool to see them all come together. And I even liked the fact that like all of these people have so many reasons not to trust each other and so much bad history, but you know, they're welded together, and like maybe that's a way to understand the Cersei part of it, that like if you could crack her impenetrable smug skull with some idea that like, look, if you don't stop your bullshit, everyone will die. Mm-hmm. Let's take care of this, then we can get back to killing each other. Maybe it'll work. Maybe.
Yeah.
At my most charitable.
She does want to fight and die as opposed to surrender and die.
It seems like, even if it's possible, that the fact that all the good guys are on board with the good guys and gals are on board with the plan is a bit much. So
okay.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper makes an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price, and I've been sleeping very satisfactorily on a Casper mattress for the past 3 years. And it's not like it replaced, I don't know, a bed of broken branches and glass. Like it was a very, very comfortable high-end store-bought mattress, and I got the Casper and I slept on it and I threw the other one right out the window. Get out of here. It's garbage. Because here's the thing, like, and I've tried memory foam mattresses before, and sometimes, like, you know, they'd be too hot or they'd be a little bit too firm. Casper's deal is that they've, like, got a bunch of different blends and layers to give you just the right amount of sink and just the right amount of bounce to give you the kind of temperature that's comfortable in a wide range of sleeping conditions. And the other thing that's really cool is that you can try it for 100 nights risk-free. They dropped this thing. I got a king-size mattress. It came in a box about 2x2x3. If you've ever had to get a king-size mattress up or down a two-story apartment building or something, or three-story, it's such a pain in the butt. And this thing just comes, like, all compressed, and they got a special tool that slices it open without damaging the patent. The thing just flops out and expands to its full size. And it just makes it so convenient. And if you don't like it, they will come and pick it up and either have it recycled or hauled off at their own expense. So it's completely risk-free. Like, you can't do that with any other conventional mattress. Mm-hmm. Go to a mattress store and say, hey, I want to yoink this thing for 100 days. I'll return it with sweat stains and God knows else on it, and you'll be cool with that, right? They will throw you out. They will call the cops and have you arrested. That's a fact.
That's happened.
That's not a Casper talking about. That's just a fact that everyone knows.
Right.
Casper won't do that to you. Over 20,000 reviews, an average of 4.8 stars. It's becoming the internet's favorite. But do you know how hard it is to maintain a 4.8? I know
we've tried it. We don't have it on
iTunes
this podcast.
Reviews.
Yeah.
It's really hard to keep the high four nines when you get thousands of reviews. They got this thing on lock. Free shipping returns to the U.S. and Canada. Hmm. Even the lands of always winter in Canada. Free shipping and returns there. It's designed, developed, and assembled in the United States. Bottom line is, if you're looking for a great mattress, Casper's got it. You can get $50 off any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/GOT and using our exclusive promo code GOT at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. If you want a better night's sleep, check out Casper. Today's podcast also sponsored by Bald Move at club.baldmove.com. You can join the club and get a bunch of exclusive off. It offers just the right bounce, just the right sync for your podcasting experience. It's obsessively engineered club experience.
Is it? I mean, I work on it in my spare time when I'm not doing podcasts. So the club experience is a little weak, I gotta say. But the content.
Content strong.
Content's great.
Content game is strong. You get
memory foam based content.
You do. You get ad free podcasts.
You do.
You get a bunch of exclusive bonus audio content, such as our Quit Your Pitching series, the Empire Business series, where we talk about what's it like to be behind the scenes of a podcast startup. Lunch with Jim and Aaron, our Friday afternoon spectaculars, where we just get on the mics and talk about whatever. It's a general interest podcast exclusive to club members, and a lot more. Also, you can watch us record most podcasts. It's the quickest way to actually get a podcast. You can see where we goof up and where we have to make edits and stuff. It's a good time for everybody. All that and more can be had at club.baldmove.com. And hey, you also support us making all these podcasts essentially for free. The vast majority of our content is available for free for anyone to enjoy. We just like to incentivize people to support us with a little bonus content. And, you know, you get a little karmic reward for helping the little guys out here at baldmove.com. So go to club.baldmove.com, check out the pitch there, see all the special features. And, hey, test drive it for 30 days free when you sign up. Check it out, club.baldmove.com.
Why don't we get the feedback?
Sure. Rashida D was listening. So, you know, of course, we've got a little bit of old business to get to first. Was listening to the 704 recap, and you mentioned that Bran knows the treachery that Baelish has been up to. Why is he still walking around? Never read the book, so all my knowledge of the Raven is show-based, but appears the Raven sees he doesn't do. The Raven we first met is in a cave connected to a tree. He may have affected things telepathically, as he got a glimpse of this possibility from Bran at the Tower of Joy, but has never concretely expressed that he, the original Raven, manipulated situations. It doesn't seem like the Raven is supposed to interfere with the goings-on of regular folk. I'd be a little disappointed if the Raven used his power to settle personal scores. So do you think there's this unspoken prime directive amongst three-eyed ravens that they're kind of like a Gandalf, that they're allowed to advise and give information, but they're not really allowed to directly influence the course of the struggle?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how the line of ravens would be sort of continued without some sort of interference. Like, if you're going to perch yourself way up in the north where no humans go, how are you going to get it seems like to me like you have to tell people, hey, come up here, or force them to come up there to pass on
your... Well, that's the thing. You can offer the invitation, whatever. But, like, Bran could have just rejected it. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference between influence versus, you know, whereas Bran just says, oh, Sansa, Littlefinger did this, and oh, by the way, he also did this, so probably should cut his head off.
I mean, what's the difference between sending a raven that, you know, says, hey, you need to deal with this problem here? Like that is not manipulation because it's known to the person receiving the message, right?
Yeah.
But it's certainly pushing events in a direction you want them to go.
Well, but on the other hand, ask Kirk, Picard, Janeway, Sisko, and whoever the fuck Quantum Leap dude was what the Prime Directive means.
Sure.
I bet you get five different answers.
Right.
Yeah. So
Max von Sydow wouldn't have done that shit.
No.
Bran's taking liberties.
He's more of a Picard, you know, original constitutionalist view.
Bran's
the
Kirk, I guess.
Bran's the Kirk.
Okay.
Or he could be the Janeway, because Janeway was like completely roll of the dice, flip of the coin about how she'd interpret the Prime Directive.
Right.
Like, will the Prime Directive fuck my crew over? Then I will absolutely. Will it settle a petty score? Then fuck the Prime Directive. Anyway. OMC. I've been listening and reading lots of reviews of last week's episode and the season in general, and I'm a bit disappointed not hearing any more respect for Sansa, who I think is doing an amazing job running Winterfell and managing family reunions. The most important point, I think, has been missing is what I vaguely anticipated her reunion with Arya to include. That is, Arya saying, I took out the Freys, and Sansa saying, I took out the Boltons. Sansa won the Battle of the Bastards and full-on murdered Ramsay Bolton in perfect revenge. Cold-blooded as any of Arya's assassinations. They have each worked to protect, revenge the family. They're totally on the same team. They're incredibly capable young women. It was lovely to see them greet each other with affection and treat each other with respect and the spoils of war. Oof, about this week. Looking forward to deeper connection and collaboration in the future. I am too, and I think I've talked myself into thinking that this is a Sansa-Arya tag team of Littlefinger.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything else just is a regression to their previous states of character development that I don't like.
Yeah, and I mean, we, in the episodes where they deserved it, we have given them praise, right? That reunion was good, yeah. And we talked about it. The moment they had down in the crypts together. I think this episode, like, Sansa's really... She's walking a fine line in patience here.
Right.
Because I think that's the only thing required at this moment of her is to just fucking be patient.
Right.
And that's a very difficult thing to do when you're faced with the weight of a lot of, you know, lords of houses screaming at you saying, this is fucking stupid. We want to do something. We've got this threat looming. Being patient in this situation is difficult, and I applaud her for that.
Yeah. Sasha says, although I will say, I think it would have been cool if there'd been like, yeah, I killed the Boltons, I killed the Freys, that'd have been, but you know.
High five moment, freeze frame at the end of the episode.
Yeah. Sasha says, am I the only one who's grossed out by the thought of John and Dany together? I mean, they're related. People are using just, I'm just going to cut you off and say, apparently, yes. Yes, they're the vast majority of internet people want to see the dragon niece get down and dirty with her wolf nephew.
Because that's not how we think of them, right? I mean, we've talked about like what is the problem with the familial relationship when it comes to like to those extended family members, right? Like,
yeah,
the problem a lot of the times is the familiarity. That's the thing that makes it so squicky to human beings.
The taboo,
and they don't have any of that.
Right. The taboo on incest is probably mostly because it fucks up our population genetically. And secondly, most cases of incest you can think of have some sort of power imbalance. Like,
sure.
You think of a 50-year-old aunt preying on a 15-year-old nephew or something like that. Something
right.
you're taking advantage of someone's youth and experience. In this case, you're talking about, you know, like, isn't it technically okay for cousins? Like
genetically,
just genetically, not morally, ethically.
Right, we're not talking about that.
Like, I feel like there's certainly a lot of states in this here union that allow cousins to marry.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what's the difference between an aunt and a nephew? And like, there is no, like, they're literally equals.
Right. And I mean, importantly to the story, yeah, yes, okay, now it is starting to become a little weird now that we know John's true parentage, John's true roots. But for so long, we've been thinking about them as completely unrelated people. So it's very difficult to get out of that mindset, I think, at least for me.
Yeah. No.
To see them as brother and, or as what, aunt and nephew, I guess. Right. Is that what the relationship is?
Yeah.
Is very difficult for me.
Sure.
Because I've never known them as that.
And like I said, like I would, if I would break down my percentages, I'm saying like 95% of my feedback is roughly let them bone. And
right.
5% is like, is anyone else disturbed that this is an aunt and a nephew? So
yeah.
You're not alone, but there's a lot of people that take a look at Kit Harington's abs and lats and manly good looks, and a lot of people looking at Amelia's curvy shape and just wanting to mash those things together, hardcore, sure. HBO style.
Yeah.
So, and I'm kind of like, my problem with it is narrative. Like, I'm not squicked out by it necessarily for all the reasons we talked about. It's more of just like, I just don't think that's the story George is telling.
Okay.
Like, this isn't a happily ever after ice and fire forever and ever until death did they part kind of thing. Or if the death parts them, it's going to be swift and brutal. Hectate. There are at least a few characters who, if they survived the end, might make a lot of sense as new recruits to Night's Watch, such as Theon, Jaime, Jorah, even perhaps the Hound. But will there be any point of a Night's Watch to exist when all is said and done? Even if the Wall is still standing, with the Wildlings now invested in life south of the Wall and the others presumably gone, is there any other reason to continue the practice of sending disgraced and defeated Westerosi north to take the Black?
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly think there's value in it. The what-if factor.
Right.
You know, that alone kind of seems like it's a good thing.
Right. Like, you can't colonize the lands of every winter. It's like, with their technology, there's no way you can, like, effectively garrison and secure it. So
right.
How can you ever be sure that you've permanently dealt with the threat? Like, you don't think that anyone in the last 8,000 years have asked whether it's stupid or not to send men?
Yeah.
Obviously, the answer is yes, because the wall is severely undermanned at the start of the series. So, yes, it would be foolish to just completely abandon that post, but also no, I would imagine that if the White Walkers take another 1,000 years or so to regenerate, that all the same bullshit will probably happen. And maybe that could be something that George is telling us, the fact that, like, and it seems like a lesson we're doomed to repeat as a species, that you cannot outrun, like, the repeating effects of history. Like, as desperately as you want your future generations, like, once things get out from living memory, such as, I don't know, fascism and Nazis, like, once that stuff falls out of living institutional memory, it starts creeping back up again. So,
yeah.
What are you going to do? Keep fighting it. Keep manning the wall.
I have a question about Randall Tarly being sent to the wall.
All right.
By anyone. By his queen, another queen.
On-the-spot made-up answer. Ready
awesome.
To go.
Randall Tarly implies that he could be sent to the wall to become part of the Night's Watch. Don't you have to take an oath? Don't you have to, like, earn a spot in the Night's Watch?
I mean, there's, like, it's a
two-step
process.
Why have an oath if you're just sent there as a punishment, I guess? Like,
yeah, like, there's a two-step process, I suppose. One is you have to be, like, sent to the wall, and then secondly, you have to be...
Or choose to go there.
You have to take the oath as a Black brother.
Okay.
Now,
so you could be at the wall indefinitely, forever, and just never take the oath.
I think that...
What happens to you?
I think that you'd be remanded to justice if you just refuse, like, if you want to be a conscientious Night Watch, you know, objector, that they're like, okay, well, you were going to be hung for stealing a horse slash betraying the Dragon Queen, so that's going to happen now.
What if you just never quite good enough at a thing?
You try. I mean, fucking like, you can't
he was a fine,
you can't shovel shit out of a stall. That's the thing. Like, you don't have to be a ranger. You can be a builder, you can be a smith, you can
what
be
if you
a
break
maester.
Your hands, break both your hands, lose your hands. What if you're Davos with, except he's the
fucking Maester Aemon was blind and probably couldn't control his bowels or bladder. They'd still
yeah, but
had
he was
him
a maester.
And, yeah, okay,
yeah, he was the info guy. He still had a brain and a
yeah.
mouth.
I don't know. I don't like. That's a good question. How do they handle malingers? How do they handle, like, you know?
I imagine they just let you die if you maim yourself to avoid
probably.
Your oath.
Probably, yeah.
They're like, fine, the
infection
go forage.
The infection would kill you. Yeah. Like, let's be real. They don't have Neosporin.
It's true.
They got milk of the poppy. They got the moon tea, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Anything, if you're pregnant, they can make you not pregnant. If you're in pain, they can make you not feel it. Everything else,
right.
You're fucked. All right, Funk, after listening to yesterday's episode, you discussed John taking the Stark name at the 55-minute mark. I was thinking about what would happen if, hypothetically, John and Daenerys got married. Typically, you take the man's name in marriage, but with John being a bastard Snow, would he take the Targaryen name? Could he take the Stark name? Do we have any background from the books or otherwise about how that would shake out?
He's not a bastard. He's a true-born Targaryen.
Yeah,
apparently.
But so... That's kind of settled that he could he's a bastard. I think if you're legitimized, which I think since John's the king in the North, he can self-legitimize because only the king or queen can legitimize you. So if you're the king, like even the concept of being a bastard, what the hell does that even mean? Like you'd have to make a strong stand of like, I like being a bastard and I don't want to legitimize yourself.
Yeah.
If you're legitimized, I think you can take. Your family's name. If you're a bastard, like we talked about how you kind of like inverse the heraldry and you can like start your own house name. Like, for example, the Blackfyre Targaryens got their name when one of the bad kings, the Aegon the Unworthy, mm-hmm. legitimized all of his bastard children on his deathbed. And, you know, these guys are previously called themselves the Blackfyre and had gone with the Black Dragon on the Red Field. We're now legitimate Targaryens and could take that the name if they wanted to. As far as marriage, it seems like Game of Thrones follows the same rules of modern day royalty where you can't marry into royal blood. So like Queen Cersei Lannister would not become Queen Cersei Baratheon just because she married Robert because her blood is not royal blood. Now that she's the queen of by her own right, she could be. But like Prince Philip did not become a Windsor when he married Queen Elizabeth, nor did he become a king. He's the prince consort. So okay. It's one of those things where like it's the royal blood that matters, and that's where the last name stays.
Gotcha.
So there you go. And if you want to know more, go pester a Brit about it because I don't know more than that, and it makes my head hurt thinking about the whole titles and heraldry and all that. Also, don't bother educating me on email because I'm not going to read it. Don't care. Ryan D., in the 704 recap, you mentioned how ruthless the Dothraki were and how difficult it might be for them to integrate into modern society. This got me thinking about Dan Carlin's excellent Wrath of Khans podcast. He explained how the Chinese Yuan dynasty began with Kublai Khan, Genghis's grandson, but after only a generation or two, the children, the Mongols, got soft, started enjoying a more modern Chinese urban lifestyle, etc.
Hell yeah.
Giving all the other Mongol parallels, I wonder if they'll hint at the Dothraki becoming more Westerosi by the end. I wonder how they're enjoying Dragonstone so far.
The Xbox in the Dragonglass Cave.
Right.
John finds.
I mean, you can already see how like Khal Drogo started to go a bit soft.
Uh-huh.
When he was getting honey dicked by Danny, it's like, we have to do all this raping and pillaging. I don't, you know, like it's, that absolutely is a real thing. Like to the extent that some cultures have this edge because they don't have creature comforts and they, you know, are more inured to hardships and heat and cold and things like that. It's amazing how quick you lose it. Once you get some silks, you get some silk sheets. You get some warm food in your belly. You get a roof that doesn't leak over your head. And suddenly you're afraid to lose all those things like all of other soft people.
Get a sweet, sweet Casper mattress.
Right.
You're done for, man.
Yeah, you don't want to lose all that.
Survive in the harsh winter.
So I think you might be onto something here, Ryan, that they could show, I mean at least hint. And there's probably going to be generations of, you know, the racist bullshit they're going to have to overcome, and they're going to be not quite seen. They're going to be seen as new rich or newly entitled. But, like, you know, the reality is they could be the lords and ladies in a generation or two of significant houses. I mean, because, like, forget the, like, that. What is the original Westerosi? They're the children of the forest. Mm-hmm. And then it was the First Men, and then it was the Andals. So it's like this happens all the time. Some horde of unwashed savages comes over the continent and takes everything over. They will be integrated like everything else. They'll be like the new gods will be the horse gods and whatever. Mm-hmm. Edward R., I know you're going to do season 2 of Game of Thrones after this season, but when are you going to do season 3? If we really have to wait a long time for the final season, would we be able to get season 3 coverage before the final season?
So, never. We're just going to leave a blank spot. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
There's a lot of discussion. I think our original plan was we would do every backfilling season because we didn't have the first three seasons of Game of Thrones for reasons that is too long to explain here. We backfilled season 1 after season 6 of last year. We're going to do season 2 after season 7. And our thought was just to finish after season 8, we just do, you know, season 3 and then we're done. Now knowing that Game of Thrones is not going to come back to 2019, I could see us doing like a random Game of Thrones coverage in the middle of next year because everyone's going to be kind of hankering for it.
Yeah, and in one of our slow spots potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. The plans for seasons 2 and 3 I think are still up in the air, right? Mm-hmm.
No, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm pretty committed to doing season 2 after this season.
Okay. All right. I got from a conversation earlier that you were questioning that, but
I'm not saying it's going to be super fun and it's there might be some tight scheduling, but like I think it's the best. It's best for Bald Move, for sure.
Okay.
But season 3, I mean, the only thing I tell you is like subscribe to our social media and follow us on baldmove.com.
Subscribe to this feed too, because that's where they'll pop up.
Right. And we don't just randomly drop bullshit. Like if you subscribe to a feed, the next time you'll see a new podcast is when we have something like, you know, valuable to contribute, like another season, either season 8 or season 2 or season 3, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be like just blowing up over stupid stuff. John S. says, hey, guys, do you remember how many Dothraki warriors Dany has with her? I seem to remember the number 100,000, but I'm not sure how that refers to the total number of Dothraki, men, including men, women, and children who now follow her, or what?
So I don't know how many she left back in Marine, and I don't know how many she was able to bring over on the boats.
Right. I think 100,000, because here's the thing. Dany had Drogo's Khalasar at the beginning, which was the largest of them, but it was just one of many Khalasars ran by various Khals that, you know, spring up, break off, retire, get killed, all that stuff. She now has all of the Khalasars from everywhere. Like, all the Dothraki have now sworn allegiance to her. So she's got a shit ton. Like, when Jaime says that this Dothraki army couldn't be beat by any army he's ever seen, that's a huge thing for him to say, because he's seen, you know, armies of 20, 30,000 fielded against each other at any one time. So, like, it's a big number, but are the double Ds sweating numbers right now? It doesn't seem to be.
Yeah.
You're supposed to believe what you've been told, which is it's big enough to defeat single-handedly any army on Westeros right now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to the new stuff now. Adam S., when Arya's following Littlefinger, you hear Raven's call multiple times. From my count in his room alone, 5 separate times. As much as it seems that Arya is being set up by Littlefinger, who thinks he's so fucking clever, could it actually be that Arya sees through this and knows he's being played, and Bran is already watching Mr. Chaos in the act? With his Ravens and Arya not being such a stupid little girl anymore, together could they convince Sansa that it's time to survive as a pack and finally bring an end to the sniveling, conniving prick that has been a thorn in the Stark side this whole time? What do you think of the counting crows in the room here?
Because I didn't notice it.
I didn't either. I did verify that it's true. I'm open to the idea that the Stark alliance extends beyond Sansa and Arya and includes Bran too.
Mm-hmm.
As he postulates, maybe this is going to be Bran and Sansa teaming up to teach, you know, the teach reason to Arya. I don't know. But I like it. And I remember there was a lot of, in season 1 and 2, there was some talk about like paying attention to when crows are in the backgrounds and some potentially, and I don't think that anything came of that, but like, you know, obviously now the crows are very associated with Bran being his eyes and ears. So if they're including all that crowing there, it's probably significant.
Yeah.
Or maybe Littlefinger's room's just underneath the rookery. I haven't seen a floor plan of Westeros. I don't know. Or the Winterfell. I haven't seen where they checked him in at, but you never know. Andrea R., why bring Gendry back if he's not to play an important role? Is he going to be important for him and his lady Arya? If you recall, in previous seasons, he always referred to Arya as his lady. Is he going to found the new House Baratheon, and does that even matter at this point? Is he actually not a bastard and is actually Cersei and Robert's firstborn black-haired beauty son that died from fever? Would Cersei know or care that it was him? Is that Robert's actual Warhammer? And if so, how did Gendry get it? Whew, there's a lot of questions that I don't have great answers for. Let's take them in reverse. Is that Robert's actual Warhammer? I say no.
I don't think so, no.
But like I think the fact that he works at the Streets of Steel, that you're supposed to understand that in part of his preparation is that he made himself a bomb-ass hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of disappointed that he didn't make himself a bull-headed a helmet or a stag-headed helmet that he can wear, because someone should fucking wear helmets. Like, they're not even wearing hats up north. What the hell?
Yeah.
Is this Robert's firstborn black-haired beauty son who died from a fever? Doubt it.
Yeah, I seriously doubt it too, but there's nothing that says it isn't, I suppose.
I mean, that's a show-only thing too. That was a speech that in season one, famously, the Double Ds asked for 10 episodes worth of budget. They got it, and then they wrote like 8.5 episodes worth of script, started filming it, and realized they were short. So yep. they wrote like some of the best stuff in season one. There again, ammunition, if you want to say the Double Ds are hacks, look at this. Some of the best stuff is show-only stuff, like the conversations between Cersei and Robert, the conversations mm-hmm. between Cersei and Catelyn, where all this stuff came out. So I would tend to not think of that, since that's a show-only thing, and the fact that Gendry's showing up late in the series means he's important, which probably means he's important in the books as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we're supposed to understand that.
Yeah, it's apparent that Gendry will have some bigger purpose in the story, though, which surprises me.
Would Cersei know or care? I doubt it on both of those questions. Would he found the new House Baratheon? I don't know, and I don't know what it would mean for the plot. Like what would that look like?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always think of like questions like this as like imagining how the throne rooms, like the celebration scene at the end of Star Wars goes. Like, if Leia, instead of just handing out medals, had to be like, okay, Han, now you're the disgraced son of a Corellian pirate, and you get to found the House Solo. Like, who gives a shit? It's the end of the movie. Everyone's happy because they won.
Yeah.
Like, Gendry going and getting a castle, I don't think is going to be dealt with. Now, him and his Lady Arya. There's a lot of talk in the beginning phase about like if that was going to be some romantic angle. It sure doesn't feel like it at this point, though.
No, but an episode ago I was saying Gendry's never coming back, so what the fuck do I know?
Confirmed. Gendry and Arya.
Yeah.
Garya is the thing.
Everything I know is wrong.
Yep.
Everything I think will never happen is right.
All right, Evan G., I was listening to your instant take, and I was wondering if maybe the roadmap, which you guys jokingly referred to as a couple of bullet points, that Gurm gave the Double Ds, is just leading them down a completely different road than he is actually planning to going down in the books. Possibly just as a way to fuck with people, or as a way of rewarding the book readers with a more true ending, or maybe he's using it as a method to figure out which direction to actually take the books by finding out what works with an audience and what doesn't.
I don't know what to say to this. Like, what a colossal asshole you must think George Martin to be.
Yeah.
To purposely take a multi-million dollar production on a weekly fucking basis and troll them. That's based on your own goddamn property. Like, you're not trolling just the fans of the show. You're trolling everyone. Like, No way. He's not doing it intentionally, but he might change the story later. Like,
the more interesting,
and you'll never know the difference.
That's the more interesting thing is him seeing the audience reaction to some things. And yeah, all George can say is like, either this is how I would do it or how I wouldn't, or like, this is how I would do it, but it's not working because it's not well explained. So I can better explain it, and people will like it better.
Sure, and I think that's totally plausible.
But him to deliberately mislead the Double Ds into something. First of all, like, from what I heard, these conversations took place in the very early goings before the first episode was written. And if it didn't sound good or plausible, the Double Ds would probably be like, "What the fuck?"
Mm-hmm.
But everyone, you know, like, I got the idea that their minds were relatively blown by some. Like, I remember there was some sort of behind-the-scenes material where they're talking about, for example, Hodor dying. And that was one of those moments they talked about, that there was like four or five moments in these notes that George gave him where they're just like, oh, shit, that's cool. We got to nail that right. And, you know, I'm not sure what others to come, if there's been some that we've already seen. I don't know. But, yeah, he's only human. I don't think the books are going to be written, to be honest. If they are written, he would be a fool not to take information from the show to try to either better explain or better pull off the things that Double D's either failed to do or failed to satisfy the audience, or to just really lean into the stuff that works well, that are big crowd-pleasing moments, because why wouldn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, you can at least get a sense of why people didn't like certain things.
Right.
If it was too rushed, if it didn't, you know, fulfill their expectations.
Right.
And then maybe write around those problems.
I certainly don't think that George, like, I think the creatively fulfilling way to do it would be to ignore everything that's happening on the show and just write in a vacuum. But so, I already know, because he goes and, you know, he goes on his blog and tells people, like, oh, that's not how I would have done it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, the shows are very, like, so he's paying, he's keeping up with this. So the creator going in a vacuum and telling a story, that's off the table.
Yeah.
So, but I'm with you. I don't think he's that big of an asshole. KDP says, overall, why I'd say I enjoyed this episode, even with its fast pacing, I do have some complaints. There are about 50,000 conversations I wanted to witness. Jorah and Jon and the Mormont sword, or Sam's connection to both. Gendry and Jon discussing Arya, for example. The Hound discussing Arya and Sansa with Jon. The list goes on. That's a really good point. Like, Gendry says, I met your dad once, not that I was with your sister for the better part of 2.5 seasons.
Uh-huh.
Like, that seems kind of crazy.
Yep.
We
didn't talk about the problem of the brothers.
What?
The two brothers. Remember, we were speculating on, oh, maybe Jon, you know, knew about
Bran. Right.
And in this episode, he says, I didn't fucking know Bran was alive.
I issued a fucking correction that the King of the North didn't get.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there's a way you can say that, like, he knew Sam told him he was alive, but he figured
alive at some point. Yeah.
And I know what it's like to be north of the wall. He's a crippled boy with this other little girl. Like,
but
there's
then,
no way.
Retrospective, that two brothers thing doesn't make a lot of sense
right.
either. So,
right.
The fuck? Yeah, something's messed up there.
Yeah, it didn't. You're right. That we could have counted some coup on that. Let's see.
Sorry, I totally interrupted.
No, Katie's fine. She said it's okay.
Okay.
I find that with these people traveling such distance together, it would give them more time to make some of these connections, and I find it hard to believe that they aren't. But as a viewer, we'd assume that they just don't get to know each other any better during their travels. Hell, Tyrion and Varys had time to discuss a billion important things on their way to Essos, and Tyrion was literally in a box for the majority of the trip. I find the lack of these connections disappointing. I agree. Increasingly, I'm not understanding why they did 7 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that particular number. Maybe it's just because they couldn't afford to film the spectacle we've seen and get full 10 episodes. But on the other hand, when you throw around terms like afford when you're talking about the largest television show in the world, that's very hard for me to believe.
For sure.
So I don't know, because you're right. It's not like in previous seasons we didn't get long conversations of Tyrion and, you know, Varys in a fucking wagon. We saw Lady Olenna and cruising around in a wagon. We saw lots of different, like, you know, we used to call it the traveling roadshow. Bronn and Tyrion.
Yeah, it's just a symptom of reaching the end and having to get to the conclusion at a rapid pace.
Right.
I mean, those scenes aren't not being shot because they can't afford them. They're not being shot because they don't have time for them.
But is that true? Because, like, why does everyone have to meet on the fucking beach of Dragonstone? Why can't there be, like, a scene on a boat where they're sitting down and actually making these meaningful connections? Like, it's the same amount of verbiage and screen time, but you're now suggesting the passage of time,
right,
which alleviates some of this jetpacking complaints. You're giving more time for the story to breathe. You're not really increasing the budget.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of those scenes are being done because you need to show some interaction. Like, they're trying to show some interaction between characters that are parting ways,
mm-hmm.
and they're also trying to stuff in, like, interaction between characters who are not parting ways into those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they're just trying to shortcut it from both ends, and it's not quite working.
Right. Yeah. Matthew L is the first guy that brought up the problems with Maggie DeFrog's prophecy. I wanted to give him credit and the feedback about, like, does this invalidate the prophecy? Does now that she's got, because we already knew she had 4 kids almost, and now she's going to perhaps have 5. Is it going to kill her in childbirth? All those questions, and by the way, we'll talk a lot more about that in the spoiler edition if you want to wait for that. Moving on to Bradley H. The sequence of the brand-controlled crows is pretty cool, but I think my favorite part was when the Night King looked at them and they dispersed. Do you think Bran deliberately retreated once he realized the Night King saw him, or does he have an ability to somehow disrupt Bran's warging?
Yeah, the latter was my impression of the scene.
Right.
Brandon seemed almost disturbed by the Night King, Night's King, whatever the fuck he's called, being able to break his spell over the ravens.
Yeah, he's like Zoolander. He whipped that blue steel. And Bran couldn't maintain the warg through it.
Yeah, no, it shocked him. yeah, he seemed surprised by it, almost. Or not surprised, but like not like he willingly broke off that connection.
Yeah. Okay.
That's just how I read the look on his face.
All right. And then his reaction of like, you know, when we finally got them back in Winterfell seems like not as nonchalant as if he had just deliberately closed contact. It seemed like it was a little bit of psychic force being used.
Yeah.
On a similar note, I was wondering just how much the Night King knows about our main characters. He's met Jon, he's met Bran while greenseeing. Does he know that they're related?
He's met? I mean, they're not exactly shaking hands
he
here.
He raised his... He had a full gloat-based language conversation over the water.
So.
He raised his hands. What more do you want? Come at me, bro.
I don't think he knows anything about them other than these are the leaders of the forces I'm trying to destroy.
Well, I mean,
I couldn't say that for sure.
Yeah. Like I said, we got to make an appeal to ignorance. We don't know how this stuff works. It's possible through the psychic connection that he's divined everything that Bran knows about, you know.
Right.
Or if they're to the extent that there is a special relationship between the Starks and the Wall and the Night's Watch, which has been hinted many times in both the shows and the books. Maybe he would be able to sense their Starkness, this ancient bloodline. I don't know. I don't know. Like, the Starks go back to the founding of the Wall. I don't know that. I know the Baratheons didn't. They're an offshoot of Targaryens. You know, there's a lot of, like, you know, the Casterlys got taken over by the Lannisters at some point. The Gardeners got taken over by the Tyrells. Like, a lot of there's ancient houses and there's ancient houses. And, like, the fucking Starks are an ancient house. So if anyone's going to have some kind of special psychic relationship with the Night King, it'd probably be them. But that's just me making wild-ass guesses.
Yep.
Let's see. Adam S. has a real quick question. I've been to Iceland a few times. Actually, an observation. It's kind of cool. I've been to Iceland a few times. Fantastic place. I'm slightly obsessed with it. I mention this because myself and my partner, Jen C., recognized in a preview for next week the most photographed mountain in all of Iceland, Kirkjufell/Church Mountain. It's a very distinctive land formation, absolutely unmistakable, and is famous for how particular it is. The preview for next week's show shows John's team walking to a mountainous region with Kirkjufell in the center of the shot, apparently framed as their destination. Note, this is not the first time I've recognized Kirkjufell on Game of Thrones. Per the attached screenshot, the same mountain is clearly featured in the background of the scene when the Children of the Forest made the first White Walker. Dump, dump, dump.
All right.
See, before he asked this email, I was assuming that was going to be like the Fist of the First Men or something. That's interesting, the fact that they're potentially journeying to the birthplace of the White Walkers. I don't know what to make of it. But the photographic evidence is unmistakable. I mean, it is literally the same mountain.
Yeah.
I think that the people on the Game of Thrones production know that. I think that they probably intend us to recognize the location in context, and maybe something amazing is going to happen.
Maybe.
But I literally don't know anything other than those details, what it could be.
Yeah, it suggests to me that something important is going to be there, and I don't know if it's just going to be as simple as more scribblings on more rocks that John is going to recognize.
Spiral.
Yeah, yeah. It could just be as simple as that. Or I think we saw that there were a lot of stones set up in a specific arrangement at that location.
There is. That's the spiral.
Yeah.
Was around the ritual that they used to convert the dude into the White Walker.
But what significance that's going to have to these seven dudes?
And also, more importantly, what significance is it going to have to Jon? Because Jon didn't see that vision. Jon has no idea how the White Walkers were formed. I don't think the Night King is going to take his time to explain with an elaborate hand-raising gestures what it means to him.
Yeah.
So it could just be like an Easter egg for us, or it could be something to
bring. Or Sam's on his way up beyond the wall, and he's going to roll up with the
scroll.
Right, yeah.
right.
Who knows?
I don't know. Seems like a very Jurassic Parky episode next time. A lot of running and screaming.
Yeah.
Cherie W. Why is it not mentioned that Randall Tarley actually fought for Danny's father during the Robert's Rebellion? The Tyrells and her bannermen were the only ones that stayed loyal. Were amongst the only ones that stayed loyal to the Mad King. Why is Randall willing to die for Cersei for all the monarchs he's been loyal to? He's betrayed his liege lord Tyrells. Why can't he change his allegiance now? Great questions. Like we mentioned in the main podcast, that there is a difference between supporting a local versus a foreign-born queen. Mm-hmm. There's the fact that they don't like the Dothraki and they're afraid of them and they don't respect the eunuch army. I mean, I think those are good are they good reasons? I don't know. Is there any reason good enough to die by Dragonfire? Probably not. But I think these are the reasons that he chose and cited himself for dying rather than bending the knee.
Yeah.
It is... That's always a question, like, you know, whenever there's like a, you know, present day Earth versus Independence Day type of like thing, like they always seem like you can't ever give up. But is it okay to give up sometimes?
To give up? Like when the extinction of humanity is at stake?
Yeah.
I mean,
no, not okay. That's a bad example because the Independence Day guys yeah. are going to like take our oceans and atmosphere and leave us with nothing,
right?
But let's say if they're like a Danny situation, we're like, okay. Look, we just want to conquer you on behalf of the Federation of Planets. You can largely live okay. as you live. It's new yeah. management.
If it's an Earth final conflict situation,
you have to swallow your pride a little bit. But that's we're not going to be freezing you and eating you. We're not going to steal your oceans. It's just going to be like. At what point are you just a pig-headed moron for dying for a feudal cause?
Yeah. I think Randall Tarley was at that point.
Yeah.
I would have said, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. You got the dragons.
Right.
You got the armies. You're yeah. right.
I'm learning to be a little schemer, a bit of a schemer here.
Yeah. But, this is the final oath that he has left in his life, and he is very much a man of oaths.
I will say that it would have been sick, and I would. This is one of the things that made this episode better, is if Dany had just... Like, surely she knows enough about Westerosi history, or Tyrion, mm-hmm. that was right there beside her, would say that, like, you fought for her father.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're the OG Targaryen loyalist. What the hell? Yeah. But they didn't do that.
No, I get the decision. So I guess I get the decision from Randall because he's an old man, and he doesn't have much time left, and this is the hill he's going to die on, literally. Dickon, I kind of understand... where he's coming from, too, because he's raised by this man, right? Like, the thing that was most important yeah. to him, it seems, is impressing his old man.
Right.
And living up to his standards. And so, when right in front of him, his old man refuses to bend the knee, I can't see Dickon going any other way.
Yeah. I mean, just...
And it's almost tragic, in a way, because right. Randall has raised him to be this, and right. when he shows himself to be true... this is his worst nightmare, right?
And he's literally... And, you know, these guys... Follow the faith of the seven. That's the other wild card. It's like, you know, I'm talking as a secular humanist atheist. My life is one of the most precious things because I'm never going to get another one. If you believe that you're going to go to seven heavens or seven hells if you do the wrong thing, that really changes the arithmetic.
Sure, yeah.
So it's hard for me to put myself in a place because I don't have the father, mother, maid, warrior, smith, stranger, danger looking over and judging my actions. So anyway, Adam B, now that Gilly has told us that Rhaegar had his marriage to Elia Martell annulled and had a secret marriage, presumably to Lyanna Stark, that would make Jon Snow the true heir to the Iron Throne. And if you wonder why that is, Rhaegar is the oldest son to the Mad King. You have to exhaust all of Rhaegar's eligible children before you can jump back up the family tree and then go down to find Dany as the heir.
Right.
So what happens should both Dany and Jon learn of this? Does Dany back off her quest, saying that she is the rightful heir? Does she then back Jon, or does she feud with Jon and tell him that he needs to step down away from any claim to the throne?
She's kind of pinned herself in a little bit here
yeah.
with this whole, my name gives me the right to be queen.
I don't think that's her entire claim, but that's a big part of
not,
it.
Yeah.
It's a big part of it.
It is.
What do you think she would do?
I think she would suggest... some kind of mutual rulership.
Such as like a marriage alliance?
Yes.
So 95% of the internet can be happy and 5% can just go vomit right. uncontrollably.
I think so.
That's essentially asking the question is Dany a mad queen or not?
Yeah.
Because if Dany's not a mad queen, then Jon is a decent, honorable guy who has what's best for the realm in mind would make probably a good king, mostly because he doesn't want to be. Secondly, he's got the rightful claim. So if she goes to war and spills blood over that, that's kind of Mad Queen territory.
I guess I question what she means exactly by break the wheel, because if breaking the wheel is, you know, your idea of kind of toppling the whole system of rulership, then she would still probably view her claim as more legitimate, and she probably wouldn't want to be queen, you know, in the end, but she wouldn't want anybody ruling over it, period.
Yeah. So you're saying is like, I can't guarantee that the wheel will be broken if I let John take the wheel.
Right.
So that metaphor worked out better than I thought in my head.
Yeah, John take the wheel.
But then again, it's like, there better be some scenes where she tries to win him to her side, and I think he'd be pretty easy to persuade that, like, hey, we need to make sure that people have more direct representation, or however, it just seems like as the weeks go by, my idea that I've had for seasons and seasons that this is going to end up in some sort of democratic institution. I'm not saying it's going to be really 21st century UK, like constitutional monarchy with the part, but
she won't be signing any constitutions.
But on the other hand, anything less than that doesn't have any, like what are we wanting? Are we wanting like a Magna Carta, which is more between the lords and the king than it is between the people? But what would be believable? But I know, what is believable in a world of dragons and ice zombies? Functional democracy? Impossible. Okay, Mike R. I don't even like to be asking this, but has John just signed his own death warrant? Before departing Dragonstone, the last thing he tells Danny is, I wish you good fortune in the wars to come. You know who else said this exact line? Mance Rayder, right before he was burned at the stake by Melisandre, and also Sir Arthur Dayne, right before he was slain by Ned Stark and company. This sign has almost become a sign-off for big characters as they take what is coming to them right on the chin.
Sure.
Counterpoint is, it could also be... the force is with you. May the force be with you of this universe, and we just only seen it go badly.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. You know, it could just be something badass warriors say to each other as a way of saying goodbye, and Game of Thrones being what it is, most people saying goodbye are doing it for the last time.
Also, what is death in this universe? You know?
So if John, that's the other thing I want to say is, like, if John dies, Thoros of Myr can bring people back to life. Unless the Lord of Light's done with John, he's functionally immortal.
Right. You got to kill Thoros first, is my feeling on the matter.
Right.
And I don't know if the Night King knows this, but he's the healer of the group. You got to target him first.
Yeah.
And then take out the tanks.
Yep. You got to kill the medic before you take out the heavy weapons guy.
Yeah.
You try to do it the reverse, it just doesn't end well for you. Matt P. says, maybe it's not that Daenerys and Jon have the hots for each other after all. Rather, they sense some sort of special blood bond a la Luke and Leia that goes beyond mere lust. Perhaps the idea of marriage doesn't feel right to her, like how Lorraine McFly reacts after kissing Morty. At any solid sci-fi references, I gotta say.
Yeah, it's
at
all
any,
good.
You got a future in podcasting, if I'm any indication. At any rate, would we socially accept the two heroes committing incest as a happy ending? Again, 95% of us totally down for it.
Yeah,
but
I'm cool with it.
I was actually somewhat surprised that their goodbye was so chaste. Like, didn't like embrace. They didn't have like a particularly long. Like, clearly, Danny's got something going on. This might not be a bad way to interpret this. Like, they definitely feel some kind of connection and bond, but it doesn't feel like it. Like, the Luke and Leia analogy is pretty solid.
Yeah.
Pretty solid. Like, there's every, like, we should be attracted to each other. We should, but there's this, it's something that's icky, and I don't know.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. I don't know why it would work that way, but that's a perfectly valid way to interpret it. Okay, this is the last thing we're talking about, because some people love this topic, some people fucking hate it. It's a crowd pleaser for the people that are willing to be pleased. It's a discussion of who's the best in single combat.
Oh, Jesus.
Richie G, okay. Here's my request. I'd rarely indulge this, and it's going to be at least another season before I do it again. Rank seven, John's crew of seven going north of the wall from worst to best in single combat, and then could Arya beat straight up the best with no face swapping?
No face swapping?
Yep.
I feel like that's tying one hand behind her back. That's
right.
That's a skill she's got, man.
Right.
This
reminds me of like a Super Smash Brothers throwdown. Like,
I mean, I think John's man, John or the Hound, because those are the two that I feel are the best.
So we got John, we got Beric, we got Thoros, we got the Hound, we got Jorah, we got Gendry, we got Tormund.
Yeah. In my mind, it's either John or the Hound as the first, and then Tormund cleans up. John or the Hound as first and second.
Okay.
And then Tormund right behind.
I think the Hound, hands down, is the best fighter, period.
Okay.
Like, he's got this. And I'm old school. I pay attention to size and strength, all things being equal. And, like, with Arya, it's not. But,
right.
But, like,
speed.
The Hound, very wounded. It was everything that Brienne could do to defeat him.
That's true. Yeah.
And she ended up kicking him off a ledge, not necessarily just straight up beating him.
Yep.
So I think there's no way Jon can beat the Hound. He's got the reach, he's got the size, he's got the strength. I'm pretty sure Jon has beat Tormund. Have they gone one mano a mano?
Man, I can't remember. They've been friends too long.
He certainly
now
defeated wildlings, and you know Tormund's the best of the wildlings. So, sure. Like, it stands to reason that Jon could defeat him. So I'm thinking Hound, Jon.
I mean, they've always made such a big deal about what a great swordsman Jon is, right? Like,
right.
He's the guy who does all the training at the Night's Watch. Like,
he's got the Valyrian steel sword,
right? So I put Jon way up there. You're
White
probably
Walkers
right
in single combat. I mean, that's pretty fucking impressive.
Yeah.
So
the Hound, Jon, Tormund, Beric.
Oh, above, so where
we haven't
we,
seen
so
enough about Gendry yet.
Gendry is strong as an ox. Mm-hmm. He's got the Warhammer, but he's largely untested in battle.
Right.
Thoros
isn't beating anybody.
Jorah is like was active in the Robert's Rebellion.
I put him under
He defeated a much younger Dothraki warrior with used his armor and his superior essentially battle technology. Where'd you put him?
Yeah, I put him under Beric.
Why under Beric?
Because I've seen Beric fight the Hound, and he did a pretty damn good job.
With his fire blade.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, Hound
has
a weakness
to
fire.
Oh,
this is
so
a
you're
rock, paper,
a handicap?
Scissors situation. Like, could John sets a sword on fire, he wins the against the Hound in a route, right?
Plus, I haven't seen Beric fight after his latest death. Like, how much is he diminished, right?
Right.
Like, Jorah's older.
Right.
Beric's been killed once or twice more.
Right.
Those guys are a toss-up for me, I guess.
And then here's the thing. Like, Thoros in the book, like, fought and won in a lot of tournaments. And, like, especially he was, like, the grand melee champion. Like, he would, like, when you just have, like, a bunch of dudes in a field and just beating the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
He was a crowd pleaser, and he did better than you'd expect. But I think in this company he might be like it's either Thoros or Gendry at the bottom in my mind, because I think it goes the Hound, Jon, Tormund, Jorah and Beric. I'm gonna say are like kind of like equally, and then it's Gendry and Thoros somewhere in the bottom.
I think we're on the same page then.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So there you go.
Man. I expect them to die in reverse
order. The most raucous
order
panel by far I ever attended was
Great Debates.
Great Debates. Joanna Robinson. I always want to say Lannister. Joanna
no,
Robinson.
No.
She moderated a panel where it was like, who's the best sword fighter in Westeros? And holy shit, it was like attending a riot. Like, there's people screaming at and like booing and jeering and cheering suggestions, and it was decided by audience screaming essentially, like in a tournament style. And I honestly don't remember who won, because that's how little I care about these fake medieval fights. So
yeah,
but some people love them.
Some
people scream and yell for an hour about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're though, then maybe this part of the podcast satisfied you. All right, that's it. If you'd like, it's not it for our coverage of the week. We got a lot more to discuss in the spoiler section, a lot more questions to answer, a lot more delving into whether things technically satisfy prophecies or not. Still a couple of tricks and twists in the books that we're looking at. It is for people that have read all the books or adventuresome show watchers to check out. We do not.
Or obliged podcasters.
Or obliged podcasters. We do not talk about production spoilers, so don't be like any like it, it's. We're not that kind of spoiler podcast. It's more of a spoil lore, mm-hmm. Emphasis on lore. That's Friday. You can send feedback into that still at GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. You can also follow us at baldmove.com and on all the social medias, essentially @/baldmove. Yeah, we'll wait to see what we make of it Friday, and then we got two more episodes to go.
That's it. The season's coming to a close.
I hope that we'll see that this is the connecting episode that wasn't quite all connected mm-hmm. in an otherwise stellar, if abbreviated, season. My fear is that we're seeing the beginning of the weight of this stuff sagging and not being able to recover to momentum. Although, you know.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Wall-to-wall, CGI spectacle, throw in Ghost, get him off the milk carton, throw him into battle.
Yeah.
Everything's forgiven. We'll see. We'll be back Friday. We'll see you then.